Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 367.
The podcast episode
365. No,
65. Sorry, I'm a little out of sorts, everyone.
We just skipped a couple episodes.
Yeah, this is the first podcast I've recorded from my new home, which has currently no furniture in it except the couch that I'm sitting on. So, and I just got the internet set up literally about 20 minutes ago. So. We're really flying by the seat of our pants, but luckily we're all together this week. We have John here. Hey, John.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Johnny. It's great to be here, buddy.
Mr. Lindemann. So that means we're going to be doing our top five. And of course, you'll also be hearing from Guillaume Viette.
Hooray. Another all positive episode.
I expect it will be. And we also have, as always, Mr. James Jones.
I probably will not be positive at some point during this episode.
I knew I forgot something. Yeah. Okay. Almost all positive.
Even his top five includes games that he hates and that he thinks are objectively bad.
I didn't say hate, but you can have a top five game that's not all positive.
That's really depressing to even think about.
You can pull it off, James.
It's meta.
So we are going to be doing our top fives of 2013, a very fun tradition we've been going for the past few years, and I'm excited for it. I just got my list tidied up. Anyway, we're going to start off with new business as usual, because there's some pretty cool stuff to talk about here, and I think James and I are going to tag team this first one. James, I know you were excited for the Bravely Default demo on 3DS, as I was. And luckily, I just had some travel time, so I had lots of chances to play my 3DS, and I pretty much beat the demo. I expect you did as well.
I did.
Which took me about 10 hours.
I cleared it in about 6.
All right. Well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beefy demo. I mean, yeah. For a free demo, that's nuts.
Let me just say, I think this demo is better than some actual, like, pay-for RPGs on 3DS, such as the Dimpom Men. On the eShop, I'd say
it's a high bar you're setting, Johnny. You sure it lives up to it?
Hey, both of those games are about $10 each.
They come by wave, Johnny.
I think the Bravely Default demos.
Ringabout doesn't come by wave, does he?
No, thank goodness. But James, why don't you kind of describe this thing and tell us what you thought of it?
So, if you've been completely out of the loop, Bravely Default, I can't remember what the subtitle is in the demo.
When the Fairy Flies.
Yeah, which it? I'm not sure if that's the title of the demo or the subtitle they're going with in the game.
I think it's the subtitle in Europe, and it was not supposed to be the subtitle in North America, but it's still in the demo, so who knows anymore.
Perfect. This game is sort of a continuation of the Final Fantasy IV Heroes of Light game that came out on the DS in 2010, I guess?
Yeah.
It's sort of a attempt to refresh early to mid-decade 90s Final Fantasy gameplay mechanics into a more modern packaging to present this very retro-style JRPG that has the trappings of a modern game. So with that comes things like class systems, you know, your real bone standard turn-based combat, and they give a certain sense of changing up these really old gameplay mechanics by introducing some new concepts into them that sort of breathe new life into this relatively, you know, basic gameplay structure.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to start off by saying, obviously, Bravely Default is a horrible title that they should have gotten rid of. And as far as what they should have replaced it with, they should have just called this Final Fantasy something.
I know why they're not doing it.
Well, I respect that they might want to start a new franchise, or maybe they think Final Fantasy has a bad rap nowadays.
That's the real reason. I think they want this to be as far away from Lightning Returns as possible.
Yeah, but this really is a Final Fantasy game. I mean, it looks like one, it feels like one, it sounds like one. It really, I think it really recaptures the Final Fantasy games that I love the most back from like the Super Nintendo era. So I think it's kind of sad that this could have been the game to save the Final Fantasy franchise, And instead, you know, I guess we have to look forward to 15 maybe, but, I just think it really kind of does a disservice to this game because no one's ever heard of Bravely Default. You know, you hear that and you think, what the hell?
But and, you know, I think you look at what its predecessor. I mean, this is effectively a spiritual sequel to Four Heroes of Light.
Mm-hmm.
That game, pretty much, even though it is still officially Final Fantasy Four Heroes of Light, that game colloquially became referred to as Four Heroes of Light. I think it lost its Final Fantasy moniker in the public perception. So maybe they just cut to the chase and said, "Nah, we're just going to give it its own name and be done with it."
Yeah, but from what I can gather, Bravely Default is probably in some ways more like a traditional Final Fantasy in the way the job system works.
Yeah, it is. I mean, they both use job systems. It's just Four Heroes was a much more abstract job system where instead of leveling up jobs, you collected gems to sort of update the hat and gain more powers.
Yeah.
It's really bizarre.
It also had that sort of, I don't know, what would you call it? Like kind of a watercolor look to it.
This game still sort of has it.
It does, but it's actually, to me, reminds me a lot of the visual style of Final Fantasy VI on Super Nintendo, but made 3D.
Well, maybe the visual style of the booklet of Final Fantasy VI.
Yeah, I'd say I don't see Final Fantasy VI when I look at this game.
I do, you know, the town and that's in the demo, the town actually kind of reminds me of Narsha.
I see 8 other mechanical clockwork towns I've seen in JRPGs in the last 3 decades.
It's kind of a trope at this point.
Yeah, but I don't know. There's something kind of muted and not fuzzy, but like kind of dark and
it looks painted. I think to some extent,
yeah.
I think it reminds me of the Four Heroes game, but the color palette is much darker.
But I think the battles definitely have kind of a painted look to them. The first town, I think the visual style is super interesting. I've never really seen anything quite like it.
The town is sort of like running across a pop-up book. It's very two-dimensional. But at the same time, there's some level of depth to it that it's hard to perceive. Except the camera's moving in and out to sort of enforce it.
Yeah, and the different like kind of surfaces or the different structures in the town that you're moving in and around and on top of, they kind of really skirt that line between looking like old school sprites and looking like they might be made of polygons that can shift against each other with the parallax effect of the 3DS screen. And then they do this crazy thing where if you just stop moving for a couple seconds or right when you enter the town, you get this really zoomed out, super high level, or super far pulled back view of the town.
Yeah.
And as soon as you start moving, it very dramatically zooms way in.
It's almost disorienting.
And it's amazing. Like I did it so many times. I just wanted to see that happen over and over and over again. And I cannot wait to see that happen in all the different environments that are going to be in the full game. It does it in the dungeons too, but the dungeons are a little more typically laid out like a kind of modern RPG. So it's not as impressive when it happens in the dungeons, but in the town, I just found it absolutely captivating to watch that camera effect
The perspective of the dungeons is different. It's not you looking dead on to the center of town like you're sitting on the horizon. It's more of an over the shoulder kind of view. Because
it's not over the shoulder. It's just an isometric thing. It looks a lot like Final Fantasy 3 and 4 on the DS when they did those 3D remakes of those.
I would say it's even a little bit more anchored than that. It's the dungeons themselves, at least in the demo, are really quite short. But that may just be because they're demo dungeons. They're just basically little mazes that you can see about maybe a third of the maze in any given moment.
Mm-hmm.
You should sort of move through it.
It's not really a maze, then.
They're not really mazes. They're not much of mazes.
Get your logic out of here, Guillaume.
Yeah, I mean they're actually kind of shockingly tiny when you get to the first one.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing where I wonder if maybe the demo doesn't give the best representation of the final game.
Well, supposedly also the demo is full of fetch quests that, and the full game has none.
Yeah.
Like, you will not be doing, you know, like, get 7 beast livers in the full game, but that's all the demo asks you to do, which is a little bit disappointing.
the demo itself is made up of the characters are already in a party, they're in a town, and they're meeting with the local leadership of town, and they're basically being like, hey, we have some quests we'd like you to do. And as you do them, you unlock the next quest. And they start real simple, like, hey, I need you to collect 7 of these things from these monsters that are just outside of town. And the reason it's 7 is because that's how many it takes for you to level up to be competitive in the next place they send you.
Yeah.
So they're just sort of forcing you to learn the combat system and grind a little bit before you find yourself inside a dungeon.
Yeah, it's kind of a demo conceit.
Yeah. So by the end of it, they're like, hey, there's this boss we need you to kill. And there's something like 5 of them. So it's a relatively deep demo. It brings you through the entire, basically it runs you through the entire game's engine from overworld exploration to equipment to the class system to these secondary classes to like support skills you can attach. The battle engine, all the different tactics you can employ in engine. It also exposes you to the little like town that you help rebuild, based on your street pass friends that you get. It's a very exhaustive explanation of what makes the game go.
Yeah. And by the way, if you're going to try the demo and you haven't already, immediately go into the little village, the street pass village, and make sure that you turn on street pass because unfortunately, I guess this is some kind of, standard process that Nintendo requires of every game, but the Street Pass isn't automatically on and you have to go through a menu where you say, yes, I want to turn on the Street Pass. Yes. Cause I was like, man, why am I not getting any Street Passes for this thing? Surely I was at the Denver airport, which is kind of like, as I noted on Twitter recently, it's kind of a Street Pass haven. It's like a insane number of Street Passers at the Denver airport. And that's not the case even at other large airports I've found. And it wasn't until I had went in there and I was like, what the hell is this village thing anyway? I was like, oh, this is the street pass and I have to actually turn it on. It's once I did that, like 15 minutes later, I had my first street pass for the game.
Right. And not only do you need street passes, but you need to street pass someone who has the demo as well.
Right. So I went to a basketball game on Friday and I got some street passes, but didn't get any hits on that. So I had to do all the village with the one person you get. It takes forever. But basically, the idea of the village is you allocate your street pass people to projects, either reclaiming new territory or building or upgrading buildings in town. Mm-hmm. And doing so gives you access to better items, better weapons, just better equipment. You get bonuses for completing tasks.
Right, and it's a little bit like the mechanics of some social games or some cell phone games where you assign these people to this task and it's going to take 10 hours. Or if you've got 2 people on the job, it's going to take 5 hours. And those tasks are require real time, so it's the time is going to go down while you're playing the game or while you're in sleep mode.
It doesn't take very long to get everything in the demo.
Sure.
But I imagine there's going to be some stuff in there that's just evil how long it takes without street passes. Now, the one perk is in the full version, but not in the demo, you can register friends over the internet and download their character into the village to allow you to build more stuff more quickly.
Right. So it's not too offensive, I guess.
Yeah.
The street pass is really optional. I mean, you can build that village without any street passes. It'll just take a lot longer. Yeah. So I think it's a clever mechanic. I mean, I guess it's a little creepy with the microtransaction stuff, but I will never use that. Certainly wouldn't recommend that anyone ever buy that stuff. And I don't think you need to, especially with, Nintendo Zone. We haven't really talked about this much, but, Nintendo recently upgraded the Nintendo Zone Wi-Fi spots around McDonald's and Best Buy, Starbucks. Even the Denver airport has one actually. They might be in even some more public places, but they've upgraded so you can get, I think, at least 6 street passes in one go, depending on how much traffic it gets. Mm-hmm. And that works really well. It's nice to go out for just a really short errand trip. Maybe I walk out to the grocery store, I pass by a Best Buy, and I get 6 or 7 street passes in one go. And that used to take, maybe even if I'm in an area where I might reliably get 1 or 2, it would take a week to get that many. And now you can go out and just in one blast, you get a whole bunch. And then you clear them out, you take credit for them, you get your puzzle pieces or whatever. You can go back and do it again the next day. I think it's a very elegant solution to the America problem of Street Pass. And it still gets you outside. You know, it's different than if you just got that stuff from connecting to the internet and, you know, from the comfort of your couch, picking up all that stuff. Of course, you can hack it to do that, but I still like the idea of Street Pass. I like that it, you know, it's something that exists out in the physical space of the real world. And I think this is a nice compromise where they've essentially made it asynchronous. You know, you're still right. Passing by other people in your area who have gone by the same place, but you don't have to be at the same place at the same time. And it still works really well. And I'm glad it's taken them probably way too long to get to this point of finding a solution for it. But now that it's here, I'm very happy about it. And it's a big boon to stuff like Bravely Default. It actually enables these features and it makes them really valuable to the experience. Whereas before they might have been, you know, kind of a neat thing on the box, but nobody would really get to take advantage of it.
Right.
I kind of wonder if in addition to the localization, which I'm sure was a considerable effort, I wonder if they were waiting for this type of thing to be implemented in North America, like the Spot Pass thing, before rolling out this game, because it seems to rely so much on Street Pass.
I think that would be Nintendo putting an unusual amount of foresight in their planning.
No, I think it's much more likely that they were waiting for the upgraded version to come out in Japan.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, this isn't the version that originally came out in Japan. This is Bravely Default, was it Plus?
No, it's called For the Sequel.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Which is the most cynical subtitle ever.
Yeah, it's a bad subtitle. Thankfully, they're not using that over here. But
because it would make no sense here either. But no,
it's the international version. So they took the original. It was very popular in Japan. They said, why don't we fix some things that people complain about, add some more features, and we're already deep into development of the sequel for the game. So why don't we make this new version of the original more like the sequel? And that way, when people play it, it'll kind of ease them into the way that we've laid out the sequel to the game, and it'll make them more consistent with each other. So in right. Japan, it sucks because maybe you already bought the game. Now, you know, if you want to play like the definitive version, now you have to buy it again.
And play it again.
Yeah, or forego that superior experience. But for those of us in the West who've waited so long, I think it's great that at least we're getting the best version of the game. And I think that's really why they probably could have released this last year, but I think Nintendo probably looked at their lineup and said, you know, this is pretty fucking good already. Maybe we don't need a game like Bravely Default to sell 3DS in 2013. Maybe it would do more good in 2014. And if we wait just a little, and you know, it's coming out in early February, so they're not waiting that long into the year.
Like the second or third or something like that.
Yeah. If we push it just barely into 2014, then we can get the really good new version that has all the bells and whistles and that will do better in reviews and people will appreciate it more. But, I mean, this was already probably one of my absolute most anticipated games of 2014. And after playing the demo, I'm totally into it. I mean, I know it's not going to be everybody's cup of tea. And I've heard people say, you know, it moves too slowly. It takes too much time to really get what you want out of it. It's definitely a bit obtuse up front and it doesn't explain the job system or the combat system terribly well. There's lots of pages of text to go through, but it never actually shows you anything. You know, there's no tutorial fight where it actually kind of demonstrates some of these mechanics. It just kind of, after a while, it's like, you've just been going through text for so long, you just stop reading it. You know, it's like, whatever, I'll figure it out. But if you just start up the demo and walk outside and get into a fight, you might die right away because the game is pretty difficult. The scaling of it is pretty difficult to start out with. And if you don't go ahead and put your characters into jobs and assign some abilities to them, you're going to have a very difficult time being competitive in those random battles. So it really does require that you kind of, you know, do a little bit of setup, learn how the game works before you go out and try to test yourself. But I found it to be very rewarding very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I have some issues with the demo that I think don't necessarily represent it well. I think ultimately because they didn't want to drop you in the middle of the story. They had to contrive this sort of weird place where there's not much. There's almost nothing around the central town. There's this town, big open space, and then a couple tiny dungeons way out in the periphery.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up feeling really, this really empty space. And there is a lot of these little fetch quests that really don't feel like there's any reason to be doing them. Basically, all you get is the fact that nobody in this town that you're visiting is capable of doing any damn thing on their own. And
like every single RPG.
They're like, hey, there's a dragon. We're busy.
Yeah.
Could you 15-year-olds go take care of the dragon? And that's it. That's like the end of the conversation. And they're just like, yeah, we should probably go take care of that dragon. Let's go, guys.
Yeah.
Like it's some dude in a latex mask and they're Scooby-Doo's gang. I mean, they're just like, let's go do this. Like, in the full game, that experience is probably much more consistent and paced and, you know, goes from A to B much more smoothly than in this, where it's like, oh, hey, that dragon, you guys killed it. That's great. Here's a potion for your trouble.
Yeah.
There's a big-ass troll that we've been – he's, like, stole some food.
Yeah.
Just go take care of him.
The real game also has Don Knotts.
Exactly.
Jonathan Winters.
And the Globetrotters, yeah.
You know, I think it's one of those things where if you're going into this demo looking for, like, the next big revolution in RPGs, or you're looking for something like that's, like, kind of immediately satisfying, like a little bite of a larger experience that's really going to knock you out, I don't think it's that. I think it's set up like a very old school RPG. And if you're willing to get in there and do a little bit of grinding and play around with the systems and find ways to get the most out of your characters and develop them in combinations of abilities that are really useful. And in some cases doing things, you know, over and over again in order to earn more money or something to buy the cool equipment. You know, I mean, I'm in for that. I grew up on that stuff. So for me, it's very easy to fall into that formula and that cycle. And for me, it was exciting to see the presentation. The music is just superb, especially with headphones. And it was fun to go around and just see these different places and get a sense of what the full game might be offering. But you know, I don't think this is going to convert anyone who doesn't already like JRPGs. But for me, I thought it was a really nice demo in that, it does show off some of the cool things that the game is capable of and that it has in store for us in about a month from now. And I love that it doesn't repeat anything from the full game. And I love that you can carry some of your progress, some bonuses. Basically, you unlock different sets of bonus items and things like that that'll be carried over into the final game. And that's really exciting for me. It's also a pretty snazzy marketing technique, you know, cause it's like, well, I've already put 10 hours into this. I'd be stupid not to buy the full game and, like, you know, kind of take advantage of that progress that I've made. And
oh yeah, it gives you these weird things that as you hit checkpoints, you unlock some stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right. You don't keep your progress. Your characters are not going to be leveled up when you start the full game. You're just going to have extra potions.
You basically get free equipment when you start the game up proper.
Mm-hmm. Which is nice because that kind of takes care of the complaint that, you know, a lot of RPGs, they kind of start out slow. It takes a while to earn money to buy equipment. It takes a while to level up and earn skills. So, I mean, if they can give you a little bit of a jump start, that sounds very useful.
Yeah, when we're talking about this game being old school, it does have things like random encounters. I mean, this is...
Which disappoints me, to be honest. After playing other games, I just...
It would be weird for a send-up of the mid-decade Final Fantasies to not have random encounters.
Well, maybe, but I mean, even Dragon Quest doesn't have random encounters anymore.
Well, yeah, but this game is explicitly backwards-looking. Dragon Quest has recently decided, all right, we're going to try to at least look kind of forward into the future.
I guess.
I mean, this game has a conceit exists to be retrograde.
Hmm.
And I could see why, for some people playing this demo, they're thinking, wow, this game feels old, because it is old.
Yeah, I could see that. And I don't think this would, you know, much like Ni No Kuni from last year, I don't think this should be anyone's first RPG. I don't think it's accessible enough for that.
Oh, no, God.
I think this is really more of, it's like a nice modernization of a kind of game that A, I love, and B, doesn't get made very much anymore. So the fact that there's, you know, what seems to be a really excellent one, and it's on a modern handheld platform I can take with me anywhere, and it has all these modern features and this really cool, unique presentation. I'm thrilled about it. I love the demo, and I can't wait for the full game.
There is one thing I want to talk about before we wrap up, which is the combat system. Which, I know I could be sort of a fetishist on game combat systems, because I like to get into the sort of the strategy of the game, and this particular game, where the title comes from, because I didn't, I mean, I kind of knew this, but only from reading it, is you have a choice of various actions each character can take based on their class, but then you also have the choice of essentially defaulting, which is you're just not going to move. It's like guard in previous games. But as opposed to it just being a wasted turn, you're cashing that move for the future. So you're saying, okay, I'm going to, in the future, I'll now have two moves I can make in a row in another turn.
And you still guard, so your defense is still up for that round. And there's also a thing where if you attack the next round after you go default, your attack will be stronger. And in a lot of cases, there's a certain rhythm to the boss battles where they're going to do the same thing. So when they're attacking, you want to be defending. And when they're not attacking, that's when you want to
And they're
going to
be defending your attacks. It's in this game, because you've got different elemental weaknesses in play, you may want to have your magic user default, because they're going to take a lot of damage if they get hit, default for three turns in a row and max out the amount of moves they can cash, and then splurge and spend them all in one torrent of damage.
What's the max?
You could cash up to three.
The other cool thing is you can go negative. Like you can you can gamble. So if you feel like this boss is almost dead, I just need to get in one or two really good hits on him, you can go negative and like use way more moves than you currently have banked up, and it'll send you, you'll be like in minus three brave points. Well, what that means is if you don't kill the boss with all those attacks, you're going to be a sitting duck. You're going to sit there for like three turns not being able to do anything, and he's just going to demolish you. But if it's a risk reward thing, if you're right, and if he is almost dead, and if you're able to use these moves to do a ton of damage, then you know you might end that fight. In other words, the braves, all that stuff resets at the end of the battle. So if you end up with everybody negative, it doesn't matter as long as you won. So you can go in for this huge killer ultimate move right at the end where everybody just goes crazy on the boss, and if you kill him, awesome. No penalty whatsoever. And if you fail to kill him, you're totally screwed. And I love that. Guillaume, why don't we move on to you, sir?
So in this week's, Guillaume brags about the stuff he got at Christmas. I got Retro Game Master DVDs. And Retro Game Master, if people remember, was also the title of a DS game that came out years ago. And that was based on this show. A show where the premise, apparently, is some guy, Areno, working for this fictional company called Game Center, where his bonuses, his pay, is determined by his ability to play old video games and beat them. I say apparently that's the plot, because in the DVDs that I got, there's no...
They've pretty much dropped that conceit by now.
Oh, yeah, probably. Well, by
now... Any season past seven, they've basically said, like, yeah, it's out of here.
Yeah, but...
They don't even call him Cacho that much anymore.
Right. But they just, you know, like, you say by now, but the DVDs are... I don't know who localized them and exactly what their plan was. I think they say, okay, we picked the best episodes and this is what we're offering you guys. But they're out of order. I was watching the third or fourth episode, and Areno was, you know, visibly younger than the previous episode that I had watched, you know, and so there's no rhyme or reason to the order of the episodes that I got on DVD. But yeah, like it's, so why would you watch a show about a guy playing old ass video games? That's actually a good question.
Well, he's really funny.
He's a comedian, first of all.
He's a comedian, but he's kind of the anti video game nerd. Like you watch the Angry Video Game Nerd, and it's just, you know, like his shtick is to get really, really mad at these old video games and, you know, expose the flaws and trying to make his way through them, and sometimes giving a bit of a history lesson, but most of the time you're just hearing him swear and invent swear words. But Areno is just this really affable person, and you're watching him play through Ninja Gaiden. And it's apparently his first exposure to this game. He's never even heard of it. And he's just like, oh, wow, nice cutscenes. And he's, you know, super happy to beat the first boss. And, oh, wow, this is going to be a short game. And, you know, like he's just making these really funny comments throughout. Maybe not laugh out loud, but, you know, pretty amusing. And in my case, like when you know, I knew what was coming up. My girlfriend really didn't know, but both of us were just like empathizing so much with when he reached Act 6 and faced the last boss and then had to start over Axis all over again. it's just, I don't know, like you feel his pain, you feel his frustration, but he doesn't look that frustrated, you know, like, and he keeps a pretty, you know, upbeat attitude throughout the whole show. And you'll see that the, you know, like, I don't know, I think his office changes places a couple of times throughout the season.
It does.
But in that particular episode, he's got the sun in his face at some point as the sun is setting. So you see the progression of the day, and you hear the announcer, the voiceover say, it is now hour 8 in Arino's challenge, you know, and 13 hours later, Arino is still trying to beat Act 6, you know, and can you imagine someone actually, I don't know, like they're filming this guy playing for 13 hours straight.
But did they really? I mean, it's a comedy show. I kind of took that stuff at, you know, with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
He does do the live shows every so often. So I do think to an extent they do probably film all of it. I think there's probably stretches where, you know, he's walked off and maybe they're getting him back to a
no
place
doubt.
Where he died.
Yeah, no doubt. But actually they kind of do that on the show itself.
Oh, like, yeah, on the show they'll do it too, but I think sometimes they don't, you know, they don't want to acknowledge it. They just kind of silently go do it.
Yeah.
But sometimes he'll just watch one of his assistant producers play for like 3 hours to get him back to where
right.
he died.
In that Ninja Gaiden episode, he's got these three assistants and they all relay each other. One of them beats Act 6-1 and then someone else beats Act 6-2. Someone else 6-3, and then, you know, like all that's left for Arino is to try and beat the last boss. And he gets some help with that as well. But sometimes, you know, like he doesn't complete the challenge
most of the time at this point.
Yeah. Or in another episode, Bonanza Brothers, he was actually really, really freakishly good at the game for some reason. And you hear him say like, oh, finally, it happened. After 5 seasons, I got good at video games. And he's beating this Sega game, you know, and in 7 hours, and he's looking at the crew, and I don't understand. Like, I finish early, and I don't understand this mood in the studio. Everyone is just like, oh, this is weird. there's no cheering or anything.
It's just awkward.
What's funny is as the series has gone on, they've been more open about the fact that, you know, he has extensive experience playing video games.
Sure.
I mean, he picked this format for a show himself.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
It's really hard to tell because there's no information on the DVDs itself. Like, it doesn't have a booklet or anything.
I do wonder how much they edited the show for these westernizations of the program, because
they definitely cut out a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean there's segments where like he goes to a Japanese game center. That's obviously not in there.
Right.
Although some of those segments are the best parts of the show because they're just ridiculous.
Right.
Or there's a season where he watches from the side of a skyscraper members of his crew dressed in ridiculous costumes handing off NES card or Famicom cartridges. Like their drug deals, and he has to identify what cartridge it was from up there.
What?
And he's never right. I mean, he's never even close. But just the insanity of the segment is so good that it's just high comedy in and of itself.
Right.
There's ones where he's trying to beat some game that he played as a challenge, and they said on the episode, you know, send us a postcard if you know how to beat this game. And he'll just randomly cold call people who sent postcards and ask them about the game. And occasionally you'll get like, it's a little kid who sent the letter, and he'll get his mother, and he has to like convince his mother to put the kid on the phone. And you'll just hear her scream for her kid to come. It's just ridiculous. It's the most absurd show that you can have, or most of it spent sitting in front of a Famicom.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to ask, is the only Kojima-inspired episode there of Tokimeki Memorial?
No, I'm looking at this, and okay, basically, if anyone watched the episodes as they were being streamed on Kotaku a couple of years ago, they got the rights to stream these episodes before the DVDs came out.
Gotcha.
I think it's the same episodes.
Oh, okay.
So you've got Ninja Gaiden.
They were dubbed, though, weren't they?
They were dubbed, and here you've got a choice of having the dub or, you know, like the voiceover was dubbed, and it... Arena was subtitled.
Right.
But you can also have the voiceover subtitled if you prefer. That's how I'm watching it. So the episodes are Ninja Gaiden, Super Fantasy Zone, which is looks just brutal, Bonanza Brothers, Solomon's Key, Clock Tower, Mighty Bomb Jack, The Mystery of Atlantis, SOS, Battle Golfer Yui, which is a golfing RPG.
Yes, it is.
53 Stations of the Tokaido.
That game is hard as crap.
The Wing of Medulla, Golden Axe, Shiren the Wanderer, and Ninja Gaiden 2.
Oh, 52 Stations of the Tokaido is an evil game.
I'm looking at Wikipedia right now, and there's a lot of really interesting and really difficult classic games on here that he's played.
Mm-hmm.
But on one of the Japanese DVD sets of this, there's an episode where he plays his own game.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Retro Game Challenge for Nintendo DS.
Yeah.
And it said he cleared except for the Hagelman 2 challenge. So he couldn't even completely beat his own game. I would love to see that. I mean, there's a polygonal version of him in the game, except he's a child.
Yes.
Right.
It's really weird.
Yeah. Well, and there's a polygonal version of him in the game as the computer monster.
That's right. Yeah. He is. Yeah. And he's like the ultimate, like, secret boss of the RPG. That's in there, like the Dragon Quest tribute. It's like a huge Andross polygon face of him, you know, who's like level 1,000 or something. I'd love to see that.
There's a really good episode pretty soon after the game came out where he made every person on staff show him how far they had gotten in the game, and then he berates almost every single one of them because they haven't gotten far enough.
Awesome.
It's such a weird show to watch because you do feel bad for him a lot of times. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you feel worse for his subordinates who he does sometimes take his frustration out on. there is obviously no HR system going on in Japan because, I mean, he is a comedian, but some of the stuff he says is just downright cruel. they had an assistant producer for a while who was fat, and he just laid into her all the time. And, like, they're just like, okay, this is getting a little awkward.
Mm.
But, there is something just compelling about watching him suffer through some of these really Japanese games. Like, Battle Golfer Yui is as Japanese as a game gets. I mean, that game is nuts. And its title tells you exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably about half the games he plays were never released in the West.
Or they were released in some heavily altered form.
Yeah, so without really any comprehensive knowledge of the 17th seasons of this show, I think they probably picked good games in that most of them are, you know, have come out here. And the ones that aren't, at least, are somewhat interesting, you know.
Yeah, I would imagine the Western DVD sets are probably kind of the best of. Aren't they? I would imagine they're kind of curated for, you know, some of the best episodes they would collect and put on the disc.
Yeah, I would imagine they probably targeted games that people here would know or are just so ridiculous that...
Or else the episode was just hilarious for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But this is really, you know, it's really a reality TV show. And I would not be surprised eventually for there to be some kind of American version of this. Mm-hmm. And if it's anything like Iron Chef, it'll be terrible. But I would love for this to actually become like a really good American version where they could play, you know, some games that were never released even in Japan. You know, maybe they play some old PC games, and other stuff. But I just think there's got to be an audience for this in the West where people would be willing to watch someone play these old video games and get super frustrated with
them. We have those. It's YouTube Let's Play channels.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it would also capitalize on the whole YouTube Let's Play phenomenon also. I mean, clearly there's an audience.
And a lot of those are very similar dynamics.
Oh, yeah,
there are people who people find funny playing a game that is ridiculous or stupid. I mean, there's a lot of Let's Plays of terrible games. Because they're funny to talk about.
Yep.
Yeah, the narrator is just really good.
The difficult part is that most Let's Plays work with two people. And he manages to sort of keep this going on his own.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. it's also, you know, the show is heavily edited. So
sure, yeah.
You keep 1 hour out of, you know, a session of...
A 13-hour session.
Yeah.
Of him playing a game about Japanese racing horses on the Famicom. Yeah,
it's... I think having it edited is a big help. And I also think the narrator is almost like a second person.
Oh, it's so dramatic, you know?
Like, oh, yeah. The narrator is so cheesy.
Yeah, they'll have Areno say, oh, wow, I'm getting good at this game. I'm going to beat this in no time.
What he couldn't know was up next.
Yeah, like, little did he know that hell awaits him after
yeah,
the
Yeah, it's like the gates of hell were about to open. And then they cut to him, like, going to a game center, and then they come back, and he's being destroyed.
Yeah.
Oh, it's...
So yeah,
it's a great show.
It's a very self-aware program. Yeah. I mean, it's
I would definitely enjoy the DVD set myself for this. I think I'd get a lot of mileage out of it.
Yeah, it came out last year, and it's still pretty expensive. If I don't know, I looked it up on Amazon. It was still around $50. So it's not free.
We could also hope for some kind of Netflix release at some point.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, you know, most people know this show through streaming it on YouTube and stuff like that. There's yep. tons of fan translations.
Oh yeah, there's like 80 episodes that you can watch available.
Yeah, but it's pretty neat to have this DVD set. I've been watching it with other people, and you know, people who don't have extensive experience with old video games are still enjoying this. So it's pretty cool.
It's awesome. It's a lot of fun to watch these episodes, especially the ones that get real nuts.
Well, why don't we wrap up new business with John Lindemann?
I actually received an unexpected Christmas gift. I got Zelda: A Link Between Worlds.
Hmm.
And nice. I did not expect that. So yeah, I'm enjoying it so far. I haven't actually played it in probably about a week. The last week of mine has been crazy, but I've made it through to the point where I've opened up the kind of dark world. So I've beaten the first three, mm-hmm. the first three bosses, and I gotta say, I mean, it's really smooth. I mean, it's really, really streamlined. I mean, it plays really, really quickly. And, I mean, it's just really good. I wouldn't say it's blowing me away, but it's just really, really, really solid game. I mean, it's just good across the board. I don't really know. I've seen kind of the graphical look and feel of the game criticized a little bit, you know, saying that Link is ugly.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand that.
Link is kind of an ugly dude in this game.
Yeah.
I don't think the other characters are ugly. I just don't think Link's model
I've seen thrown around is sausage sideburns. And now you can't unsee it. But
yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, I think his model probably could have gone through another round of revisions.
Yeah. It's a
more so than the others.
Yeah.
But the graphics are really, really smooth, 60 frames per second, and I think it really shows, especially in 3D, like, it just pops out, and it's so fluid, it makes it, I don't know, it keeps the illusion intact.
Yeah, and it seems like nothing, it's not a chore going anywhere, and also I got the bell right off the bat, pretty much, which just makes things so much easier. And really, it's so great. I mean,
the bell allows you to teleport anywhere that you've found these weather vanes, basically.
Yep.
Instant backtracking.
Yeah, it's instant backtracking, and really, it cuts out a big chunk of kind of the pain in the ass factor that has existed in other games in the series. You know, where you're just kind of like, okay, I get it, I know exactly where I have to go. But I have to backtrack all the way across the map, go through this, go through that. You don't have to do that anymore, which is great. I think it's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant way to solve that problem. And yeah, and you know, I also love how, you know, it's really simple to manage your inventory. Switching stuff on the fly is really good. It's just really, really well done. But I will say though, James kind of, he had me kind of checking out each boss just to see whether or not
poison the well.
Yeah, well, he kind of did poison the well a little bit, because you know the first three bosses, they are pretty much, you can just hack away at them and beat them. Like
there's no strategy.
Yeah, there's no puzzle to solve really with each boss. You just pretty much walk up to them and hack, 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 and eventually, you know, you dodge their attack, which is, they really only have about two attacks, three attacks maybe. And, you know, you can figure those out really quickly. And once you've done that, you're just hacking away at them. You just basically get close enough to them that you can just hack away and that's it. They're done. But yeah, I mean, I really like, you know, merging with the walls. It's really, really cool. It's kind of it's a way to sort of, it makes you look at the world in a new way. I had to kind of train myself to think about solving puzzles by actually, you know, flattening up against the wall. And it's just, it's just a really good game. And I, unexpectedly, I'm also liking the Street Pass battle functionality as well. I've gone out of my way to, every time I see one of those pop up, I go in there and get it. Now, you know, the one thing I would criticize with it is that you wind up, you know, fighting players that are way, way far in the game. And so they have, you know, quadruple the amount of hearts that you do. Sure. There's really no throttling on what, you know, how good the players are or how advanced they are.
Right. So, there's no checks in play to make sure that you're gonna get wasted.
Oh yeah.
There's also nothing at stake. I mean, you can only gain from trying it.
Yep. So
it's fun though. It reminded me a little bit of Four Swords Adventures had that weird death match where you've got all these links running around slapping each other with swords and throwing bombs.
But see that was just, I mean, everybody was more or less equal, and it was just chaos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that mode is so much more fun than you would ever expect it to be.
Oh, and well, it taps into the same thing that makes Smash Brothers fun, because it's just nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's just absolute pandemonium on screen, and it's even hard to keep track of who you are.
Yeah.
Yep. But yeah, I mean, that's been kind of an unexpected, you know, enjoyment out of this that I figured it would be just kind of a throwaway mode, but, the one cool thing about, you know, having my apartment so close to the street is the fact that I actually get street passes. Like, I will get street passes by people walking by on the street below. So, I actually do get quite a few street passes for the game.
By the people banging on your windows at
night. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure there's a couple of homeless guys down there with 3DSs.
I have all the hats in Street Pass Adventure.
But, yeah, really good. So, you know, I have to kind of dive back into it. But if you guys have any pro tips going forward, I'm pretty much right at the start of the Dark World. So, and
I don't think you really need a pro tip.
Yeah.
I mean, try to look for all the cracks.
Step on all the buttons on the floor.
No, come on. But for real, anytime you see a crack, take it because, you know, the portals between the worlds, because once you go through it, it'll appear on your map from then on. And it makes it a lot easier to find that stuff later.
Okay.
Whereas if you just see it and you're like, oh, cool, there's one there, and you just walk past it, it won't be recorded. And then sooner or later, you're going to wish you had made a note of it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, of course, I think you could actually draw something on the map, on the world map, and kind of make a note for yourself.
Yeah.
But it's better if you just try to get to it, go through it, and then you'll always be able to find it later.
Yeah. I mean, you do have 20 pins that you can put on the map. If you
I don't know why
you would ever clutter your map with that, but.
And you don't really tell you what they're there for. Just, I put a bin here.
Yeah.
Sure. I still found it useful for when it was clear that I did not have the items that I needed to collect a piece of heart, for instance. And so, okay, I got to make sure to come back here eventually, because sometimes in Zelda games, you miss a secret and you just forget. And there's no reason if you just follow the progression for you to ever go back to that place. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's completely useless.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, But I also will say, you know, as soon as I got into the Dark World, the enemies are a lot harder. And so I went from pretty much just steamrolling everything to coming into the Dark World. And I was like, I'm just going to steamroll everything here too. And I wound up dying a little bit, you know, just because, you have the hardest ones are the enemies that throw rocks at you. They throw boulders. It's the guys up in the mountain. They kick your ass. I mean, they take off like a third of your health with each one of those. So
So you got a visit from the repo bird.
Yeah, I did. I felt kind of bad because I was like, well, you know, James, he played this with.
Is it a bird?
Did they
actually send a bird to get your items?
Yeah, it's the shopkeeper's little bird.
Mm-hmm. That's messed up.
Yeah.
Yep. But
shame I never saw that.
Yeah,
it's awesome. I never saw it either.
Exactly.
I mean, look,
I've never seen it either.
I've heard that a lot of people who struggled with this game and who actually did die a lot and had to go re-rent the items, you know, that they lost. I've heard that a lot of them weren't putting fairies in the bottles, and and didn't even know that you could do that or why you would do that. It's just one of those. I don't know that the game ever really tells
it
you.
Doesn't,
it's just I've taken it for granted for every single Zelda game
don't you
since
have to
1992.
Use a net to get them, though?
Yeah, but you get the net
which is a little bit different than more recent Zelda games. Maybe people just tried to use the bottle, saw it didn't work, and said, "Oh, I don't know."
Yeah, I mean,
it works the same way as in Link to the Past. So again, if you've played that, you have a huge advantage, and the game feels much easier than if you've never played Link to the Past.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of things like that that you would have to figure out on your own.
Yeah, I've made ample use of red potions, so I wasn't going in. but really, I mean, really, it was just kind of
Red potion rehab.
Well, it was just kind of wandering into an area where I'm just thinking, these enemies are easy. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, shit. And before I know it, I'm down to like 2 hearts. And then I'm just trying to run away from somebody and somebody hits me with something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you get a ton of gold or like just it's ridiculous. Like I have like
rupees.
Rupees. I have like 3,500. I mean, do you max out?
Yeah, money is almost a joke in this game.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't believe it because I thought surely I'll have to buy, you know, a bigger wallet or something like that. But they just kept going up past, you know, like 1,000.
I think
2,000.
It's great.
But see, I think all this money sort of and Cole spoke about this a little bit when he was on the live show. It sort of undercuts the whole idea of, well, I can rent the weapons or I can buy them.
Yeah, that's what I didn't understand either.
Because money is such a non-issue, there's almost no reason to go through the process of renting them. You just buy them outright.
Yeah.
Well, you have to rent them first, James.
Yeah.
It's a progression.
Well, fine, but there's no reason to just not buy them outright because money is so easy.
Yeah, I mean, I walked in there pretty much right off the bat and rented everything.
The thing is, it doesn't force you. Renting them means that you're not forced to grind to actually buy them. And I think that's a good thing. And actually, Kohler in his review of the game said, oh, this whole buying items thing introduces a new unwelcome element to Zelda, grinding. I think it's false. Like, the whole renting process eliminates that. I think it's a good system.
I didn't feel like grinding was really all that much required to buy everything outright pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Because the game does heap money on you.
Yeah, sure. It heaps money on you, and you also don't die very often, really, in the grand scheme of things. If at all, you know?
Yeah.
So really, like, the fact that you can buy them, I don't really see... I don't know. I probably won't.
I don't
have
see
to do
a downside
there's
to
no,
it.
There's no downside to it.
I just don't see the upside of the renting system.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, they give
you... It lets
you
access all that stuff right really early. Because renting is
then?
Super cheap, buying is super expensive. So there's a period in the middle of the game, or in the early game, where you might have all the items, but you're only renting them. And so you're very much on edge. It's like, well, I don't want to die and lose all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the feeling as you explore more of the world and you find more caves and treasure chests and you get more money is that you start to build up your empire. You know, it's just like in a GTA game where you buy a house and you get a bigger house and you get more cars and you get more guns and you start to stockpile all these resources that then let you go out and do bigger and better things.
Mm-hmm.
And as you earn more money, you can go and buy those items and secure them, and then you know you'll always have it. And that also unlocks them to be upgraded through the Mai system. So once you find the Mai cave, which by the way, you should do, John, if you haven't found the Mai cave, you want to do it early on because you can't actually go out and find those little guys around the world until you talk to the mother first.
Yeah.
So you might have even found some of their hiding places, but they won't actually be there until you talk to her, which I don't like that aspect.
I just did that, and I really don't know really what the Mai stuff is all about, but I have been finding some of them. But so
every 10 of them that you find, you'll be able to upgrade one item that you own. That you bought.
Yeah. So, and it's very worth doing.
Yeah.
Some of the upgrades are much more useful than others, but some of the items are much more useful than others.
Yeah.
So if there are items that you find yourself using quite a bit, I would definitely upgrade those first.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't really spoken about it, but the fact that you have this kind of, energy meter that all the items share and that automatically refills over time, I think it's fantastic because it encourages you to use these items as much as possible and really experiment with them. Whereas in a lot of other Zelda games, there's some magic meter that, you know, may or may not be easy to fill up, or you've got arrows as some kind of limited resource and you never know when you're going to need an arrow to solve a puzzle. So you don't want to waste them on combat. And in this game, it's like, you know, you're going to have whatever you need once you get to that place.
Yeah.
So you might as well use whatever's best for the situation.
Yep.
And in a lot of cases, the sword is the best thing on hand. But if not, you whip out whatever you want in order to solve that situation and have fun with it. And I found it very playful and very freeing compared to some other Zelda
games.
Yeah,
I mean, it kind of prevents them from sort of, you know, throttling certain areas based on, you know, how many arrows you're going to have, for example, right? And it also saves you the time of, you know, oh, I know I need 5 arrows, but, you know, guess what? I just ran out of them. So now I have to backtrack and I've destroyed all the jars around me. So I have to go into this other room and find a jar. And, you know, it takes away a lot of that stuff. And it's just part of the overall streamlining that just makes the game feel really good.
Yeah. It speeds up the dungeons quite a bit because there's a lot less resource management now. It's more about the experimentation and figuring out what you need. And it's not about, well, I know what I need to do, but I don't have enough of that one resource or something like that. And, you know, I'll be happy if I never have to purchase bombs ever again in a Zelda game. That is the most irritating fucking thing. When you're out on the overworld, you find a place, you're like, I bet I can bomb there, but you just use the last one. And their bombs are always way too expensive in Zelda games. You have to go out and find 50 or 100 rupees so you can go buy a set of like 10 bombs that you're going to use up really quickly.
Yep.
And I love that that's gone.
Yeah.
You know, that's no longer a concern. And it's more about you learning to use your tools rather than having to, manage them all the time.
Yeah.
Before we finish, John, you wanted a piece of advice. If you don't have the Pegasus boots yet, you can already get them.
Okay.
They're very easy to find. They're outside, they're in the village. And, you've got the means to get them pretty early on.
Yes. Are they in the Thief's Tower?
No,
they're outside.
They're in the light world and they're in the village.
Yeah. Huh. Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. So is the net.
Yeah.
If you don't have the net, you can also get it there.
I do have the net. I believe I got that. You need that to get the golden bee, right?
Yeah.
Yes. And the golden bee is really fun. It's totally worth seeking that out. If you find the golden bee, it's totally optional.
Yeah.
It's kind of a little special feature, but it's really funny and it's really useful when you get it.
Yeah, I got into the Dark World and you can buy it, I think, for 999 rupees.
Yeah, go ahead and do it. Yeah. Do it and take it back to the guy in the suit.
Yeah.
It's worth it.
Yeah, but it's a fantastic game. I mean, it really is.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, that's going to wrap up New Business. We are going to take a much-needed break, and when we come back, we're going to have our top 5 games of 2013. Welcome back, everyone. It is finally time for our top 5 games of 2013. Just to remind everyone of the format we've been using the past 2 or 3 years of doing this, these are personal lists, so each one of us will have a separate top 5, so you can have fun comparing them, but we have made no attempt whatsoever to come to any kind of consensus here. I think that would be a disaster, and it's not something I want to try to do. So we will have essentially 4 different top 5 lists here. Also, we have not discussed these in advance, so they will be a surprise to us and to you, and I'm looking forward to that. I'm sure there will be plenty of overlap, but I'm going to ask the guys to try to refrain from revealing their picks in advance just because someone else has picked the same game. I think it's more fun to maintain a little bit of suspense. Of course, we'll be talking about each one of these games, but fairly briskly so we can keep moving forward. We do have 20 games to talk about here.
Probably less.
Probably less than 20 unique games, but 20 picks to discuss at least.
Sure.
And why don't we start off with Mr. Jones with your number 5.
My number 5. So my number 5 is Rayman Legends. So
nice.
For me, this was kind of a nice. There's been a lot of 2D platformers, so I can't say it was a new experience because Nintendo's been pumping them out at about a rate of 8 a day. But for me, it was a unique 2D platformer that had the sense of speed that also felt like a challenging enough platformer, but was still relatively relaxed experience to play through. It was the kind of thing that it wasn't slow, but I could still play it for extended stretches of times and not feel taxed by the process.
Hmm.
It's also, of course, it's gorgeous. It's creatively amazing. And there's so much variety in the stuff the game asks you to do that it's just an impressive package to experience.
Yeah. Nice. All right. So, by the way, the other criterion, and I think this was probably assumed, but all of these games that we pick for our top fives will be games that were released on Nintendo platforms in 2013.
Oh, shoot. I had to pull Persona 3 out.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Damn it.
So, that's a, you know, not, we didn't necessarily play them on a Nintendo platform, but they were available. So anyway, why don't we, move on to my number five, Bit Trip Presents Runner 2, Future Legend of Rhythm Alien. A game that I played very early in 2013. I think I might have actually started it at the end of 2012 because I had an advanced copy, on Steam from the developers. But, this game, you know, of course it came out on Wii U. I've heard that version is excellent, especially, that people like playing it on the gamepad, which I think is a great feature for a game like this. And, Runner 2 is, of course, you know, the sequel to the original Bit Trip Runner, which was certainly my favorite from that franchise on WiiWare. And I think,
yeah,
you know, doing Runner 2 as a multi-platform release on more, let's say, more modern, more advanced platforms with a much richer presentation. They've mostly got away from the whole 8-bit thing, but, and at first I was like, I don't like this new graphic style too much. But it actually grew on me, especially as you get into the later worlds. They have a somewhat different flair.
And especially when you see it in motion. I mean, screenshots don't tell you that you can make the characters dance on command. And
right.
That they've got several moves that are all hilarious.
Yeah.
I love it.
The animations really are glorious, and there are a lot of different character models in the game. A lot of them are unlockable, and some of them are really funny. And because the animations are so great and so varied for the different characters, it's really worth experimenting and trying. You know, they're all functionally exactly the same, so they're really just for style. But this game is very much about style. You know, it's very much about playing it in the way that you think is the most fun. It's really a game that it just kind of melts you. Like I found myself like completely losing track of time, which I very rarely do in video games anymore. But this is a game I would sit down, throw on the headphones, and play for like 4 hours until my eyes were just burning and my fingers hurt, my thumbs hurt. And I said, I gotta stop. You know, it's very easy to put down and then come back to weeks later. I mean, it's a skill that you learn how to play this game. You know, there's not really a story to it. There's not that much of a world that you have to kind of like sink yourself back into. It's very easy to play it in whatever spurts work best for your lifestyle. And, I think it's, you know, for like a $10 or $15 game, it's on sale all the time. I just think it's a fantastic value and is really a very special game and kind of like a weird, you know, automatic running 2D platformer subgenre that has been really crowded. And when they announced this, I thought, guys, you know, there's already way too many of these games. You really probably don't need to make another one of these, but I'm so glad they did. I think it's the best one. All right. So why don't we move on to Guillaume?
All right, well, I had a pretty good year in terms of games. There's a lot of games that I could have put as number five in my top five. Like I've got a lot of runner-ups, and I don't have anything really bad to say about any of them. So I decided to just pick the one that I'm pretty sure that no one else is going to mention here, and that is LEGO City Undercover.
Okay.
Yeah, you're right.
You are absolutely correct.
I thought that would make your list.
I've talked about this game so much already, but let's just say that since I've played this, this was my first LEGO game. Since then, I've gone back and played like 1.5 of those LEGO games, and I understand people's, just, you know, not really believing that this game is really funny and really fun, because it's really superior in every way to those past LEGO games. But the world that they've constructed and the characters are so absurd and ridiculous, and the jokes are actually, you know, funny and dead on, and the voice acting is so good. And during the missions, when you've always got this banter between secondary characters, and I'm just smiling the whole time. This game just makes me smile for like 20 hours straight. And then I watched someone else play through it, and I was still, you know, having a great time just following the story again. You know, and I like open world games, and I think this might be the probably the most fun world that I've had to explore. You know, like I loved Hulk Ultimate Destruction, but I didn't really like to explore that city. I just wanted to smash it to the ground. And there are other games like Bully, which were great for the story, but I didn't think that exploring the school grounds were all that fun. But somehow LEGO City is actually, you know, always interesting with various suburbs that all have their own style and their own nooks and crannies that are fun to explore. And so, yeah, I couldn't get enough of that game when I was playing it back in April and May. And it made that much of an impression that I still think about it when I'm making a top five in at the end of the year.
You've made a very compelling case for it over the past several months, talking about it several times. And for me, it's a game that I never really had that much interest in the first place.
Sure.
But after hearing you talk about it so much, I'm definitely more interested now. And, for me, this game could probably have a whole second life if they would do some kind of price drop on it. I download it on the eShop or whatever, put it on Nintendo Selects, whatever. I feel like they could come around and probably remarket this game to a whole new audience of people who bought the system since the game came out and who may not even know that it exists. I'm hoping that they're going to take the initiative with something like that.
So do I. I've seen in various publications giving various prizes, and I think that some publications actually gave this game prizes for its writing. So I'm just comforted in the fact that I am not alone thinking that this was really a fun ride and an actually cool story.
Nice. All right. So we come around to John Lindemann for his number five.
Number five is Gunman Clive on 3DS.
Why do I get the feeling that you chose this last year? I'm so confused. I think maybe you talked about it the same episode that we did the top five.
Yeah.
That would make sense.
That's
probably
quite likely, actually.
Yep, that makes absolute sense. Yep. I had to actually check this one to make sure it just squeaked into 2013. It was released on the eShop on January the 3rd, 2013.
Yeah. Hmm.
So it just squeaked in there, but I really enjoyed this. It's just a really good platformer, kind of old school. You know, you sort of have to, make sure that you're shooting, at the right height to hit things. But it's just really good. Really kind of like really kind of an unexpected treat. And actually sold really well on 3DS as well. So
yeah.
Good on those guys.
The guy who made that game is now making some sort of Zelda-inspired game.
Yes.
And it's probably not going to come out for a while, but I'm really excited about it, even though all he's shown is a couple of screens, a couple of animated GIFs.
Yeah, well, it's going to come out on 3DS because, that guy's, paying that guy's bills pretty much, right?
Yeah, basically the game sold, I can't remember the figures, but it was over like half of his sales were on 3DS.
Yeah, we buttered his bread for sure. And I think he'll take care of Nintendo fans next time around. But, for me, Gunman Clive is a game that I think it plays very well, but it's nothing super special. It's just kind of this old school, kind of take on Mega Man. But yep. Oh my God, the graphics in this game. The art
very
style
cool.
is just astonishing. It doesn't look like anything else. And, and I love that this guy pulled that off. And it actually works really nicely with the 3D effect as well. I think it really makes that stuff pop out. If you're into games that have really cool visual styles, if you're into really cheap games, really, really good, challenging action games, you can't go wrong. I mean, I know James doesn't love the game. It's very slow paced, but, I think the barrier of entry is so low, that it's totally worth dipping into Gunman Clive. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, James, why don't we come around to your number four?
Sure. My number four is Project Cross Zone. Which is...
Wow.
You will be the only one picking this game.
Yes.
This game is an absolute just fireworks show of insanity that, for whatever reason, managed to be released outside of Japan in a move that shocks literally everyone who thinks about it for more than 5 seconds. It is the complete crossover of Namco Bandai, Sega, and Capcom characters you never asked for. And yet here they are in a strategy or a tactical RPG doing some crazy bullshit. It's in and of itself, it's enjoyable because it's so insane. The gameplay is good, although it does start to drag by the end because it is so long. But to me, the most fun I have with it is when the creators of these characters clearly sat down and took characters, potentially even from different companies, and said, you know, there should be a special interaction because they have something in common. And they went and they explored this to the maximal comedic effect. And that means you get to spend time as the player sort of reshuffling your characters to find out who will provide these moments of just really intense comedy. And
it's kind of like wacky fan fiction in a way.
Oh, it totally is. I mean, there's you know, all the characters from Virtua Fighter hanging out with Street Fighter characters. I mean, because yeah. They're bros. like,
of course, yeah,
they're like, oh, hey, bro, hey, what's up? Like, they're talking about stuff like, I'm going to teach, you know, Virtua Fighter is this very, you know, staid, stoic fighter. You know, it's very, at least historically, very grounded. You know,
there's no fireballs. Yeah. There's no,
but
yeah.
Then you've got,
it's very serious. It's the thinking man's
fighting
game.
Yeah, then you've got
game.
Ken trying to talk the characters from Virtua Fighter. No, I can teach you how to do a Hadouken. It's cool. You should totally let me teach you. It's awesome. And Ken's a fucking moron because Capcom has changed his depiction into being kind of an idiot. And they're like, no, I'm good. I don't – no. That's probably not safe.
I don't need that. I know how to fight.
Like, and he's just so excited about teaching them all these powers. They're just like, no, I don't think I want that. And it's – there's tons of these little moments where they throw two characters together that have nothing to do with one another and just explore their existence. And for me, that was the real joy of the game. Well, that and the absolute ridiculous effects they'll throw on screen for no reason whatsoever other than to disorient you for 5 minutes.
Yeah, it reminds me of some kind of 80s, like, mashup cartoon.
Oh, it totally is.
You know?
It's like Captain N times a million. And meth.
Yeah. Oh, man. I still can't believe this game came out in America. I can't believe that they called it Project Cross Zone. But I'm so glad for you,
James. Oh, I'm so happy
that
for
it
me,
did.
Too. It probably sold 8 copies, but that's fine.
Yeah. All right. Well, the next one is on my list, and my number 4 is, you already heard about it, Rayman Legends. For me, Rayman Origins was a pretty cool game, but not one that I fell in love with. And Rayman Legends, I think, is vastly superior. I think it really smooths over the wrinkles, and it sort of fulfills the promise of Rayman Origins, and it does it. Especially on Wii U, which is the version I played. I think it does it in a way that makes wonderful use of the system's features. Maybe not in a unique way, because obviously the stuff can be replicated on other modern platforms, but I think it makes so much sense with the Wii U platform, and it is a great fit with you know, the demographic. It just feels right playing it on Wii U. You know, certainly the Murphy stuff is really cool. There's a lot of great ideas in there. I think some of them get stretched a little bit thin. But ultimately they're a fairly small part of the game, and the levels where you're just playing as Rayman are so fast. They're so frantic, and there's something just overwhelmingly joyful and gleeful about the way this game is presented. And it's hard not to get carried away by it. It's hard not to find yourself just grinning and laughing and bopping your head along with the crazy music and the ridiculous graphics of this game. And I think it's very, very finely tuned 2D platforming, probably one of the best I've played in a very long time. And I think it's a really wonderful game. And, you know, it's a shame that, Ubisoft delayed it for, you know, many, many months to release it on other platforms, and it didn't sell on them either. And, you know, I guess they're doing, PS4 and Xbox One versions. I don't know that makes sense. I don't really know who that's
for. You're releasing them on platforms with even less reach.
Yeah. So I don't know that they make a whole lot of sense on those platforms, but at least it's yet another chance for this game to get some kind of attention and maybe hit a few new people. It is a game that you just play it and you think, man, I hope more people get to play this. It is such a cool game, and it seems destined to be overlooked. But I think it's really pretty wonderful.
I will say, from the times I played the game at events, I was really excited with the implementation of the Murphy stuff. And I think a lot of members of the press walked away thinking, man, this is going to be really cool with the gamepad. I think by the time I got through the game, those were just parts like, oh, here comes the Murphy stuff. And I was way more interested in just the go fastness.
Yeah, I think that, well, yeah, there's certainly a change of pace. They're much slower. I think there are a lot of great ideas in the Murphy levels, but I think there are way more levels of that stuff than there are great ideas. They reuse it a little too much, and they ask you to master that stuff in a way that is not really possible with the AI. So again, if you're playing multiplayer, those are probably very different experiences, but I did play the game alone, and it was, some of that stuff got pretty, pretty annoying. But I think it, at moments, it's absolutely brilliant. And there are times when I think the touchscreen implementation is really, really clever and very lovely to kind of figure out how to get through this stuff. But it's used a little bit too much. But again, you know, I don't want to detract from it because I do think it's a pretty fantastic game. Yeah,
it's one of my very next purchases. I just know it.
Oh, you're going to love it so much, Guy. Well, why don't we hear what your number four was?
This game, I admit, probably wouldn't be on my number four if I had played the previous three games that came before it.
Yakuza.
But
no.
No. Eshrin Odyssey 4, I just fell in love with when I played it early in the year. Back in April, I think it came out. The demo really convinced me. The demo was just the beginning of the game. It just gave me a taste of having to chart your own map, of the dungeons that you traverse, and a taste also of the customization of your various party members. And, from then, you know, like, it was just, it was a no-brainer to buy the full game. And I was very, very pleasantly surprised to see that. Perhaps sometimes I felt the game went a little bit too long, you know, like I felt like I was in certain areas for a little bit too long, but then the next area would always bring new ideas and would basically renew my interest in the game and would bring on new puzzles and new ways of thinking about how to traverse these places. It's very impressive, and it's got that old school feel that that I just love, and it kind of, I just like these kind of alternate takes on genres that I've loved and that I played a lot of games in, you know, like RPGs, Japanese RPGs, but that are just completely a different taste of that, you know, like it's a different evolution of the same thing, and even though it's very old school, it's still fresh to me. You know, I love this game, and I really hope that people gave the demo a try and loved it, and you know, give this series a try from now on.
Yeah, I thought the demo was intriguing, but it didn't quite grab me. There's something about the pacing of it, or the battle system itself. I guess I didn't find all that interesting, even though I thought the exploration was cool, especially the overworld, which is like this weird, it kind of looks like a PlayStation 1 game, you know, where it's like overly ambitious and maybe the engine can't really handle what's going on all that well, but it's just exciting, especially because you're in an airship. You can actually move up and down as well as in any direction. And there are, you know, all these like random elements or giant monsters roaming around that you have to avoid, but they're also, you know, bonus items you can find as you map out the overworld. And I love that idea. I guess I also got the sense that that's probably not a huge part of the game, and that going into dungeons is really where all the action is. And I didn't find that part nearly as compelling, but,
But the dungeons that they show you in the game are very basic, but yeah, like the dungeons morph into these places, like caves where you have these fires that keep the water wet. And then if you snuff out these fires, then it becomes ice. And all of a sudden, these ponds that you couldn't cross become these slabs of ice that you just slide automatically. So all of a sudden, like, you know, you start marking these points of water as impassable walls, basically, and oh shit, now I have to rethink this whole thing because I can actually cross it on foot.
That's cool.
Yeah, and you've got, you know, other ideas like that that pop up in every different section of the game. So that kept it fresh for me, and I was really pleasantly surprised.
Nice. All right, well, Mr. Lindemann, what about your number four?
My number four is 3D Space Harrier, which I also talked about recently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but...
That shit.
I mean, I really, really enjoyed it. You know, I'm a complete Space Harrier sucker for it from way, way back in the day. And this actually really impressed me. I didn't think it would be as good as it turned out to be. It's a really complete package. Sega did a great job with a lot of the kind of... tricks that they put in there, you know, the way it saves your, it saves kind of a recording of your gameplay, after each time you play. It's just really, really well done. And, but I will say though, you know, Guillaume, I have to pick up, I believe it was Galaxy Force.
Yeah.
You're talking about? Yeah. I really have to pick that up as well. So I think that if I would have played that, perhaps it would have supplanted this on my list. But for now, 3D Space Harrier takes my number four spot.
It's just an insane labor of love. Mm-hmm. You know, like more love than you could ever imagine anyone having for Space Harrier.
Yeah.
That's an underhanded compliment. But no, it's just, you know, the amount of care and work that was put in this port is mind-blowing. And you can understand after that, you read the interviews with the developer and you realize, okay, it took, what, a year to create this port? It kind of shows.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. They didn't really have to put the effort in. They could have just, you know, they could have just thrown it out there, you know, added the 3D effect, which looks great, by the way. Especially with this game where it's all kind of sprite scaling. I don't even know if it's actually legitimate sprite scaling. Probably not at this point since it came out in like 85 or 86 or whatever. But it's just excellent. I mean, really, if you're a fan of the game, I mean, it's a no-brainer. It's probably the best. It's the best that you'll see the game reproduced outside of the arcade cabinet, that's for sure.
Nice. All right. Well, why don't we go back around to James for our number three?
Yeah, I'm about to go to something that's going to start to get weird here. So I'm actually going for my number three, Attack of the Friday Monsters.
Hmm.
Things about to get strong.
Nice.
So for me...
Very nice.
I considered
it. Yeah. Johnny sort of led the discussion on this one last week when we both talked about it. There's a couple things for me that sort of push this game up into this echelon. And one of the things is that it tells a very sort of charming in its own way, but... It's sort of a snake eating its own tail kind of story. You know, it's a story about kids who love these, you know, these monster action shows or hero versus monster shows that had gained popularity set in the era in which they gained popularity in a town where they produce them that also happens to be the site of a monster versus hero event that transpires to the point where I can't spoil the story, but it's even more so of it just sort of looping back around on itself once you understand all the intricacies of the plot. But to me, what makes it so engrossing is that while you can certainly just go from point to point and work the plot, there's all this stuff around you, these little, I guess they call them episodes that you're given. Now, they're real short, but you follow a character around and talk to them, or you talk to one character, go run to somebody else. That expose more of the story, and you get more of an understanding of this town, the Setagaya that you're taking place in, that you would have had just from playing the game. And I like how it does that relatively seamlessly. You never feel like you're walking off the main path. You're just exploring a town. And if you explore the town and just go organically, you will progress the story, but you'll see so much more than if you just try to hammer through to the end. And I really like that.
I really like how you can actually kind of juggle multiple episodes at the same time. And you don't even really have to keep track of them that well.
No. Although the game does a good job of keeping track of them for you.
It does. And it will generally point you towards the next thing that you need to do or the next person you need to talk to to advance one of them, but not always.
Right.
So it's definitely worth, like you said, kind of exploring away from the main path of the game. It's worth going and talking to the other people. And, you know, for me, I found, you know, there were some characters I didn't like that much and I didn't care to talk to them, even though I might have, you know, gotten some little extra subplot if I had kept badgering them. But there are enough characters there that I could go and kind of focus on the ones that I found the most intriguing. And I think it does a nice job of developing a cast of characters who really pack a lot of personality into a very short game.
And, I mean, no character probably has more than, I'd say, 30 lines of text. And that's probably maybe three or four characters that have that much.
Yeah, and you know, there are scenes in the game, there are locations you can go to where I don't think anything ever happens. Or maybe there's like one...
Maybe you find the little gems there and that's it.
Yeah, or there might be scenes where you might go there and there's like a single interaction throughout the entire game that occurs there. But it's still nice to go there just because they're pretty. You know, like you can go there and just kind of admire the grass swaying in the wind and the beautiful music playing. And it really is like it's kind of just a scenery game. It's nice to run around and just look at this place and be in it.
There's a great example, the police station, the police officer's there all the time. And one of the things he does is he salutes the kids because they all salute him because he's a police officer. But the other thing is that he stands there all the time because the train gates are broken and they're always down.
Mm.
So you don't know that unless you ask him, but even when there's no train coming, the gate's down so nobody can cross the tracks. He's there to make sure nobody attempts to do it because they don't know if a train's coming or not. He just stands there. And he only moves, and he explicitly only moves when stuff starts to get real serious. Because otherwise, it's his job to be here to protect this town from this unruly train gate.
Yeah, and there's also, you know, as you get near that area, you can hear the sounds of the train coming and going, and you can hear the train station announcer announce the next train that's coming. And, there's a ton of incidental audio like that. As you walk around, you overhear conversations. They might be in Japanese and you won't even understand what they are, but you can sort of infer the emotions in the characters' voices. You get a sense of place that very few games can convey, especially with such limited resources.
The train's a really great example because Setagaya exists because it's a train station, essentially. It's the central building in town. You know, pretty much everything is next to the train station. But there's a scene when you're out in the woods or out on the hill, and you can see the train deep in the background pulling into town. And behind it, you can see the smokestacks from Tokyo proper. It's just, and they're tiny little details way in the back of the image, but they're there. And it's just a nice little touch. It's a really impressively put together, incredibly ambitious in some ways, but very constrained appropriately in other ways. It's just incredibly well executed sense of place that I really liked.
All right. Nice choice. So my number three game is a game I wasn't completely sure was going to make it on the list, but then I kept thinking about it and I kept coming back to different aspects of it that finally convinced me. And that game is Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag. A game that I've actually been playing on PS4, but it is on Wii U. I've heard there were some bugs initially, but I would imagine those have been patched out by now. Ubisoft is generally proactive with stuff like that, and I know with last year's game with AC3, they patched the Wii U version multiple times, so I'm sure they've gotten it improved by now. But this game, you know, of course, I enjoyed the last game. So I'm not one of these haters who was just really shocked at how much I loved Assassin's Creed 4. I expected to like it, and I did. But, you know, the funny thing is, the parts of it that are the most like Assassin's Creed are functional, and they're just as good as they have been in other games. But you can almost completely ignore that stuff. You know, certainly there will be certain points in the story where you're going to be required to go around and do some stealth missions. You know, there are plenty of opportunities to go find little villages or cities out on the islands and run up the rooftops and go find all the vantage points and, you know, jump off, you know, you get the eagle and then you jump off into the bale of hay. And there's a lot of stuff here that you've done before, but there's also a ton of stuff that you haven't done before in Assassin's Creed. And the fact that it builds the sailing into the open world so that the Caribbean is the open world of this game, and you can explore it very freely. And there are lots of different activities in all the different sections. And the game has a really nice progression where, your dominion over the sea and your fearsomeness, your ability to navigate the ocean and to survive in some of the more dangerous areas, you really feel a progression of that as you play through the game. There are lots and lots and lots of upgrades to your ship. There are lots of ways to get the resources and the money that you need to get those. And I found myself turning the game on, playing for 4 or 5 hours nonstop, just sitting there straight through, just going around, blowing up ships, pirating, collecting my stuff, upgrading the ship, and unlocking parts of the map, and not advancing the story whatsoever. And I would never do that in any of the other Assassin's Creed games. I mean, the open world parts of these games have always been pretty lackluster for me. And the reason to play them was for the missions and the story, and the setting is cool. But the setting has never been so cool that I wanted to go around and just see everything. And in this game, I do. So, I think it is easily the best pirate game ever made. I think it's the world that it creates is, very much inspired by Wind Waker. But it's more dense. There's a lot more going on here. There's a lot more systems. In a lot of ways, it's more of an RPG than Wind Waker. And so it combines the exploration and the sense of progression and character upgrades and really fun ship combat and actually challenging, very rich, very rewarding and satisfying ship combat that changes quite a bit through the game as your capabilities improve. I think it's a special game. And, even if you've never played Assassin's Creed before, no problem. Jump it. They don't give a shit. They're not going to ask you to understand a bunch of weird lore and stuff like that. Just jump in, play for a couple hours, get your ship, and you're off to the races. Great. This is great. And again, I appeal especially to people who love Wind Waker and who love the sailing in Wind Waker, as I always have. Love going out to those islands and being excited about what you might discover there. This game's perfect for you. It really is. So, let's move on to Guillaume for number 3.
All right. Well, my number 3 is Tokitori 2. Ah. I reviewed this game back when it came out, and it impressed the hell out of me. It's such an approachable game on the surface. The art style is so colorful and cartoony, and everything is so cute. But then, you start solving a couple of puzzles, and you realize, oh, shit, like there's a ton of depth here. And I was especially impressed by the way that the game doesn't tell you anything and just lets you figure stuff out on your own, or very subtly guides you to understand things about the interactions between the various critters that inhabit this world, and the way every piece works together, and just lets the player figure out their puzzle game, which I think is an important thing. And I think they did that very intelligently with the just through the animation of the characters and just through letting different elements of the game interact by themselves, and so as to give you a clue as to what you're supposed to do with them, right? And what you do with them is just accomplished with two buttons. You can sing to draw them to you, or you can stomp to make some structures fall or to get some critters to go away from you. So it's a very simple game on the surface, and yet it's got very, very smart, very complex puzzles. And I just love the way that you have to dig into the game to understand it and to solve it. I went, just before we recorded, actually, for the first time, I launched a game since I beat it, and I installed the Plus patch, which supposedly, smooths some stuff over, makes some things a little bit more obvious, and I'm not totally convinced about some of the changes. Like, one of the very first things that happened when I launched the game again was that it taught me a new song to show the map. But then once I replicated that song, once I had my little character sing it, I had this message pop up on the screen that said, this song is now added to your gamepad. And that kind of stuff was not in the original game. There was no real text except for the title screen that would pop up after you started playing. You know, like it would pop up after you went through the intro, after you played through the intro.
I think those kind of little messages are a little overkill. I mean, clearly they must have had people playing the game who just had no idea what was going on. And I could see how that could happen. You know, for me, the improvements in Plus have more to do with the way the game flows and the way that, it leads you along certain paths, even though you always have the option to go wherever you want. And you always have the ability to go wherever you want. I think it kind of points you along the ideal path much better. And in a game that is so aimless and so easy to get off track, I found that it made a huge difference for me. But it, yeah, the little like tool tips I could have done without, but, it doesn't ruin it for me either.
In just a couple of minutes I played, there were, little pieces, the little collectibles that you can get in the game that are, that you don't have to get to finish the game. They're just optional. I was able to get some of them that apparently I wasn't able to get before. And it was kind of immediately obvious to me how to get them this time around. So either they really changed, like they really made some things much more obvious than before, or perhaps after a while, you know, I just, you know, you start understanding the game better and its systems just come to you naturally. You know, you just know what you're supposed to do. So I think that's pretty impressive, like that the game would teach you how to play it without really telling you anything, just showing you examples and okay, now go, you know, try to finish this.
For me, Super Metroid is probably the game that does that the best, but very few other games even come close. And I think Tokutori 2 does it approaches that for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, John Lindemann, what about your number three game of 2013?
All right. Well, I mean, my number three was actually kind of hard to fill out just because there was a lot of, I feel like just because I got my Wii U late in the year and I had sort of a lot of the easy picks. I didn't get Fire Emblem for 3DS. So, you know, I couldn't, you know, throw Pikmin on there. You know, there's just a couple of kind of no brainer.
Pikmin, John?
Well, I'm not a huge Pikmin fan, but I didn't even have the chance to really play it. I mean,
joke about throwing Pikmin, but okay.
And also, I also didn't get Super Mario 3D World. I have yet to get that, so that would have been really an easy pick for my top five list. But so number three, I decided to vote on principle, and I have to put Earthbound on there.
Ooh.
For it finally coming out on Virtual Console.
On a technicality.
I disagree with this technicality.
It makes my list just because somebody has to give Nintendo props for finally bringing this damn game to Virtual Console. You know, so it's a great game, and I look forward to going through it. I've started it, have not finished it. Of course, I'm sure that surprises nobody on the panel. But, but yeah, so that's my number three. It had to make my top three just because finally it came out.
Someone has to applaud Nintendo for wrestling the rights out of themselves, you know, having the strength to face themselves and actually release this. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Look, in a year where Nintendo screwed up Virtual Console in many, many ways and did a lot of things very wrongly on that platform across two different hardware systems. I think Earthbound is a true triumph. I think it's a fantastic thing that they released it. And, I think they've actually gotten a lot of really good, praise for it. And I've actually heard it come up a couple times on the year end lists, for good reason. There's so many people who've heard of this game, but never played it. And now they have a way to do it that's, you know, very cheap, very easy. It's a great version, great emulation. Playing it on the gamepad just works incredibly well. And that game holds up so well. I think it's absolutely fantastic that people have the ability to play it. I mean, you know, I think it's fantastic. I was able to sell my old Super Nintendo cartridge for $200 and then download this, and now I can play it all over again. And I've been playing it as well, although very slowly, like you. I kind of, every couple weeks, I pick it up for like an hour, and I'm just enjoying my leisurely stroll through Earthbound, and it is so enjoyable.
Yeah, and I mean, it was also really my first experience with kind of like the whole VC thing on Wii U, and that's really well done.
It is, yeah. It's the emulator is quite nice, actually. Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's swing back around to James for the number two. I think I'm pretty sure I know what your top two games are.
Yeah, well, number two is Fire Emblem Awakening.
Oh, wow.
Which is a game that start of the year I lavished praise on to the point where it may have become creepy.
Yeah, this is. I thought this would be your number one. And in fact, I thought it would be by far and away your number one.
It is not. It is by far and away my number two.
You called it one of the greatest games of the generation.
I did, and I still think it is.
Wow. Yeah.
Fire Emblem Awakening is a very interesting departure for the Fire Emblem franchise. It's interesting to hear that Nintendo's philosophy on this game was, we'd better do it right or we won't make any more of these.
Mm.
Because they really went out on a limb and tried to make this the best Fire Emblem game they could. I know there are some people who feel like the game may have gone too far in its attempts to bring a new life and new character to the series. I can understand some of their complaints personally, but for me, this game was fantastic. And I love the old Fire Emblem games, with one exception that I won't get into here. But if you're a fan of the series, you know which one it is. And it's just really well executed. It looks great. The character models are tremendous. Much more detailed than they've been in a previous game. From a story standpoint, you know, it's your standard Fire Emblem stuff. It just lacks the evil empire trying to eat the other evil empire stuff, where there's usually like 8 tiers of political intrigue. They just jump straight to, yeah, you're a dragon god, whatever, deal with it. But the game is fun in ways that the franchise hasn't been for me in a while, simply because I feel like I'm experiencing it differently.
Hmm. It's also great first for Fire Emblem for people who have not played the series before. I think compared to the Sacred Stones, which you might have if you're a 3DS ambassador, I think Awakening is way easier to get into and just way more enjoyable to play.
I think the addition of casual mode, which I believe was in the Japanese only DS game, the last one, I think that is absolutely changes the dynamic of the game for players who don't want to go through the series' infamous, oh god, I need to restart cycle.
Yeah.
Because it did always feel like a little bit of, you know, just a bad roll of the dice and you're screwed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a nice pressure to not have to deal with. I'm perfectly capable of beating a Fire Emblem game with insta-death on. I just chose not to do it, and it felt like a liberating experience for me personally. Now, I compensated by playing it on the highest difficulty setting.
Yeah.
Gamer cred retained.
Well, those settings are independent, so you can mix and match it and kind of set something up that works best for you.
Yeah. I mean, I've gone through 4 Fire Emblem games. I'm good on the reset in case of death thing for a while.
I just wish you could adjust those things on the fly, but I'm very glad those settings are available.
Yeah, I'm really happy with all that. I'm happy with the downloadable content. I think for Nintendo's first foray into that business plan, they presented a good value proposition. You got a lot of content for a relatively small amount of money, but it never felt like if you didn't buy this content, you were missing out. It was just an additional experience to have on top of it. I felt that the game's humor was really well executed.
Hmm.
Fire Emblem games have always been a little goofy, but this game sort of crossed into sort of a gleeful silliness that came from writing more than from scenario, as previous games did. So I think, you know, it's just a better put together Fire Emblem. And it makes me really happy to see that they've modernized it in ways that are more than just, you know, tweaking the formula and upgrading the graphics. It's a much more complete experience of a game.
Also has probably some of the best cutscenes I've ever seen.
Oh, they're unbelievably beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, they're stunning. And it's production IG. I mean, it's what you pay them for.
Yeah.
It's what they do.
I mean, this game's been very successful, big critical darling. And it's introduced a lot of new people to the series for the first time. And I really, really hope that Intelligent Systems will give a similar treatment to Advance Wars and sort of revive that series.
That series has been dormant
for longer than Fire Emblem. So
Advance Wars is a little bit harder to put the characterization around, which is probably one of the biggest changes in Awakening.
Yeah.
Is how much more the character personalities matter.
Well, you know, maybe they introduce that. You know, maybe they find a way to kind of bridge the gap between these two franchises. They're already very similar, you know, but the settings are quite different. And I don't know. I'm so excited to see what they do next, especially after the, you know, abysmally disappointing Paper Mario Sticker Star. I think this was a humongous return to form from Intelligent Systems.
Yeah, my guess is they're probably split between something new and Fire Emblem sequel.
Yeah, I'm sure they're...
Because, this game made Nintendo a... In Japan, especially, a ton of money.
Yeah. I'm sure they're going to... They're gonna.
So there will probably be a sequel announced at E3 this year or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah, well, and if nothing else, there's the Wii U game. Well, the Shin Megami Tensei.
Oh, yeah, Shin Megami Tensei X Fire Emblem. Oh, my God.
Crossover weirdness. All right.
Yep.
Moving on. My number two game is hasn't really come up yet. It probably won't be the only person to pick this, but I'm going to go with Super Mario 3D World. You know, and I don't have a whole lot to say about it that I haven't already said, but, you know, there've been plenty of complaints about this game and plenty of hemming and hawing about, you know, maybe it's a better multiplayer game than it is a single player game. Maybe it gets a little too hard. Maybe it takes too long to become challenging. Maybe the post game stuff isn't really my cup of tea. But, you know, I think a large chunk of this game is just gloriously entertaining. And I have to say, it's probably not a game I will ever play through a big piece of it in multiplayer, but I have shown it to a fair number of people. And people have never even played Wii U before. You know, they have no idea that this game exists. They're like, oh, they still make Mario games? And I'm like, yeah, can you believe it? Like, he's been around for like 30 years. They play it. And, you know, I've heard this description on another podcast, and I'm sorry, I don't recall exactly who said it, but it really does feel like, you know, if you went back and asked me in 1989, what I thought Mario games would look like in the year 2013, I would probably describe something like this. You know, it is like insanely retro in the design of it, in the graphical style, the sound effects, you know, the way the characters move. It just has this, it's so innocent and old school in the presentation. And yet the level designs, the control are so sophisticated. And I really love that kind of mixture. You know, I think the world building leaves a lot to be desired. I think the overworld map is pretty much terrible and a complete waste of your time. But there are so many magical moments in this game, and there are so many levels that really stand out as being a, you know, fairly small places, but places I want to go back to over and over and over again because they are big and wide, and there are lots of different routes to take through them, and there are lots of sometimes very well hidden secrets. You know, I think it's not going to go down, certainly as one of my favorite Mario games. Like, it's not going to be in my top three Mario games of all time. But I think it is, certainly a game that the Wii U needed. And I think, you know, if Nintendo is going to continue making games, in this sort of sub franchise of the 3D land slash world slash, I don't know, what's next, Super Mario 3D Galaxy? I don't know. But, you know, I think this is a, just a fantastic, upgrade and realization of, what they started with 3D Land on 3DS. And I think it works extremely well as a Wii U game. All right, let's move on to Guillaume.
We might as well move on to John, because my number two pick is Super Mario 3D World. I'm kind of... I'll have to struggle to find new things to say about it, because we talked about it a lot in these past few weeks, and now you just... I thought I would be the first one to mention it. it's just... It's
game
been fantastic.
Stealer.
Yeah. It was a fantastic game to play. Like, you mentioned the multiplayer and how perhaps it's not the optimal experience when you're playing it alone. But I did play with someone else, and that really made the experience pretty awesome. And I think that there's perhaps more ways in this Mario game to interact and to collaborate with another player and to screw them over also, but collaborate on achieving the different objectives than there are in the new Super Mario Brothers games.
Mm-hmm. I think it's far and away better than any of the 2D new Super Mario games.
Right, but as multiplayer games, I mean, like I think
well,
that
in any respect, I think it is better than any of those games.
Right, but I think that I think that some levels actually scale. You know, like there are challenges that when you're playing alone, you can tackle on your own, but when you're playing with another player, I'm not sure if it's actually possible to actually get past certain points without. Each player actually doing what they're supposed to do, knowing what they're supposed to do and trusting that the other player is actually going to do what they're supposed to do. Hmm. I think that there's perhaps a lot of clever and smart design decisions and a lot of clever puzzles that playing alone you might never see. But then with other people, all of a sudden, yeah, like you each have to know your role and you each have to be on the ball and do your thing to make sure that everyone makes it to the end. So yeah, it's really awesome. And I just wish that the game had more, you know, I wish that the Toad, levels were really, really good puzzles. And I just wish that I could get, you know, a full downloadable game of these.
I could see them doing that as some kind of DLC or maybe a separate release.
Right. You know, Nintendo or the developer apparently has gone on record saying, oh, there won't be downloadable content for this game. What? Why? I do want more, you know, I want more straight up platforming and I want more Toad levels and I want more Super Mario 3D World.
Yeah, I mean, as long as it's as additive, I don't see what the problem is, you know?
Yeah, I'm down. All right, John, what's your number two?
My number two is the game I just talked about. It is Zelda, A Link Between Worlds. It's really good. You should go get it.
Yeah. Must have made a very strong first impression on you.
Yeah, it has definitely. I mean, it's actually, you know, I expected it to be a quality game, but I guess I just didn't expect it to be as kind of... I didn't expect it to feel as updated as it does.
I mean, yeah, really... because it really plays like your memory of Link to the Past feels like it played, you know? Mm-hmm. But this time you have 360 degrees of movement when you swing your sword. It's just so much more responsive. And mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that have been made painless that were a little bit of a chore in the original game.
Yeah. It's like there's a lot of stuff where I'm just like, you know what? I'm really glad that they did that because I'm not missing anything by not having whatever they removed. It didn't make the experience any less, right?
Right.
It was just kind of stuff where like I didn't really want to do that anyways. So let me just get to the heart of the gameplay, and I think that's kind of like really the triumph in this game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the whole buying items thing also solves the problem of trudging through half of a dungeon just in order to get the item that you need to solve the rest of the dungeon. This way mm-hmm. you can just get the whole dungeon to have, you know, like hookshot puzzles. Mm-hmm. And, well, it's true that perhaps the dungeons overall are a bit shorter than they are in
Zelda
games.
They are tremendously shorter.
They kind of cut to the chase, I think. That's how I choose to view it.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a good way to describe the game, really, is that they kind of give you the experience without bringing along a lot of the kind of stuff that you didn't want to do. Baggage. And, yeah. they've trimmed a lot of that off.
Yeah, I mean, compared to something like Skyward Sword, it's kind of astonishing how quickly you get going and how fast that game gets, you know, really gets up to speed.
Yep.
All right, so it's time for our number ones, and James, you're up first. It's inevitable. There's only one thing it could be, really.
Yeah, obviously. So for me, my number one is Phoenix Wright Dual Destinies, which, you know, I only did a 2.5 hour podcast. It's supposed to be 30 minutes on it. It's fine.
So you like this game?
I love this game.
That's over on Connectivity, by the way. If you haven't heard it yet, it's you know, it gets very spoilerific at some point, but you can certainly listen to the first chunk of it, even if you haven't even played the game yet. And
right,
if,
the,
if you
the
have
first
played
half
the game,
of that discusses sort of the mainline plot of the series and discusses the mechanical changes in the game in excruciating detail.
Yeah, yeah.
So this was a weird game because it sort of came out of nowhere. I mean, it really didn't, because they had done the Leighton versus Wright game about a year earlier in Japan. But at the same time, we had all kind of assumed that they were going to do, you know, they were done with the Ace Attorney investigations because that had tanked pretty precipitously.
Mm-hmm.
And general response to Apollo Justice was that people weren't super on board with it.
Nope.
I don't think anybody liked Apollo. I think everybody's kind of like, he's kind of a tool.
It kind of, it's the reason why I didn't buy Investigations, really. I was like, maybe I don't need to play each and every
one
of these games.
See, I like Investigations a lot because they're just different. And
sure,
I
mean, what I mean is that Apollo, after playing Apollo, I was just like, maybe I don't need to play all
these. Yeah, because, I mean, Apollo comes off as a milquetoast douchebag. Which is a weird contradiction of terms, but it really makes sense if you played the game.
I could see myself going back and trying Investigation sometime, especially if they ever, like, you know, threw it up on the eShop for $10 or something like that.
Because Investigations is at least cool.
Yeah.
And the idea of exploring the world and doing the trial stuff at the same time, it really works because you're sort of putting things together in a much more interactive way.
And there's some of that carries over into 5.
A little bit. So what's weird about 5, because, I mean, some of that stuff started back in, you know, the second and third Ace Attorney games. What's weird about 5 is that it's much more of a visual novel than previous games.
Yeah.
It's much more down the path, run the aisle. We're going to tell you where to go. You're going to get the interactions we want you to get. And the experience is very much between your eyes and your ears.
Yeah. There are times when it feels like you stop playing it for long stretches.
Right. The game at that point is just completely going on in your brain.
Yeah.
You're just sort of working what information they're feeding you. And to me, that's fine. I'm okay with that. It's sort of like, you know, old murder mysteries. You're sitting there trying to figure out what's, you know, who's telling you the truth, what the reality really is, what sort of insane, crazy bullshit they're going to throw at you. And sometimes that can be frustrating because you're like, I know who the killer is. Just let me say it. But you sort of have to suffer through the game's mechanic to get you to that point. But at the same time, I'm so happy with what this game became because I think it's remarkably well written. I think they redeemed every character in the franchise they brought back and created new characters that are just as amusing and just as creative, and in many cases more so than any character in the franchise to date. I think they even made Apollo likable, which seems impossible because I think his game poisoned the water so badly. They found a way to make people like him, which is remarkable. I feel like the cast of extras they created is so nuts that it even replaces my go-to Ace Attorney character, Guy Eldoon, whose last name is Noodles backwards, runs a noodle stand, wears a noodle bowl for his head, and his hair looks like noodles because Ace Attorney. It replaces him as he's been replaced as my craziest Ace Attorney character by somebody in this game, which is saying a lot.
Yeah.
But to me, the real send-off for this is it feels like a consistent, full experience where I learn more about all three of the characters in the lead roles, which is something that no Ace Attorney game has attempted thus far. You either learn more about, you pretty much always learn more about his assistants rather than learning more about him.
Hmm.
And that's a real win. And I think also there's a case where you get to cross-examine a whale and your choices are cross-examine the whale or present evidence. And when you present, you say, well, obviously I can't cross-examine a whale. It's a whale. So you present evidence, and that doesn't work. And you go, no, I'm going to cross-examine a whale. And everybody goes, oh, okay, sure. Because at this point, And the characters even admit at this point, well, yeah, it's pretty much what he does. He's going to cross-examine a whale. Yep.
And yeah, if you choose not to, the judge is actually surprised. Like, what? You're nuts?
He is, actually. If you pick, no, I'm going to present evidence. Judge is like, I thought for sure he was going to try to cross-examine the whale.
That's awesome.
Like, the series is so gloriously self-aware. And this game is so well-written and indulges in the silliness of the franchise in ways that I think 4 may have missed on, mm-hmm. but at the same time attempts to do a major, you know, overhaul of these characters in a way that some other Ace Attorney games succeeded in. And it's just it's a really nice return to form for the franchise. And I hope it was successful for Capcom. I believe it was in Japan. And I have every reason to expect they're going to make another one.
Hmm. Right. And, I thought that they had announced something.
No, they already announced they're going to make it. They've announced they're going to announce another one.
Oh.
Because Capcom.
Right.
Because that's how they work.
Also, it's rated M. So, I mean, this
it's
is
rated
for,
M,
this
bro.
This is for grown-ups. But
this is serious probably, adult.
It's fine for frippery. Teenagers, too.
Yeah, I was just thinking,
in this year, there were probably more rated M games released on 3DS than ever for DS.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this game is frippery defined, but it's great for it. I'm so happy, and I'm really looking forward to the Leighton versus Wright game, because that's like pornography for me at this point. And, you know, if they put the amount of effort into the Inevitable 6 game that they've announced they will be announcing at some point when they announce it in the future to be announced, I'm thrilled. You know, if this is the bar they're going for, then go ahead, take my money. I'll pay for it now in advance. Just send it to me later.
Awesome. Well, my number one game has been brought up before, and it is The Legend of Zelda, A Link Between Worlds. Sorry, James. I really do love it that much. And this game kind of crept up on me. When I played it, I wasn't thinking this is the best game I played all year. And I think it's really only in retrospect, as I look back on it, that I fully appreciate what the game accomplishes and how much I enjoyed it. And in a sense, what John already spoke about, the smoothness of it and just how streamlined the entire adventure is and the whole progression of it, I think it almost works against the game. It makes the game is so deceptively elegant that it doesn't call attention to itself. I mean, it is so easy to play. It is so natural to blast through. It's so quick. And I played it over the span of, you know, really only 2 or 3 days. That I think at the time it didn't even really hit me how much I was enjoying it or how impressive the game is. You know, I think what it does is very difficult to do, and I think it's extremely well thought out. And I think the fact that the game had me playing for sometimes, you know, 5, 6, 7 hours in a stretch, and I didn't even really think that was a big deal. You know, like it just seemed natural. I was just doing it. And I think really that's what made me come around. Once I realized that, I was like, you know what? I adore that game. I mean, it really just washed over me. It didn't even seem like that big of a deal as I was playing it. But I think back to, you know, I know James has complained about some of the puzzles, but for me, the exciting puzzles in the game and the ones that I will forever identify with this particular Zelda game are the puzzles where I'm wrapping myself onto moving platforms that are folding and rotating through the world and elevating up. And I'm essentially doing very complex 3D platforming in a Zelda game by turning myself into a 2D texture on a wall that's like moving through space. And there's a number of places in the game where that kind of stuff happens. And every single time I found one of those, I was just floored. I mean, just really knocked out by the intelligence that went into thinking out these puzzles. And I think they really ask you to try a lot of different things that you haven't done before and to think about the space in which this Zelda game occurs in a way that you haven't even really done, even in the 3D Zelda games, like on the consoles. I think this game makes you think about your environment and how the different pieces of the environment connect to each other and how you might need to use those different pieces to move around and to get to places and solve puzzles. I think it does all that stuff in a way that I've never seen before in a 3D Zelda game. And the fact that it's on a handheld is really pretty incredible. And of course, it's wrapped up in, look, I cannot separate my nostalgia for A Link to the Past from this game. I mean, it is damn near a remake. You know, I mean, I think, you know, in a year where we also got Wind Waker HD, you know, the fact that this game is so much like A Link to the Past, it could very easily be seen as a negative. And I wouldn't disagree with anybody who said that, you know, negatively affected their experience with it. But for me, it was almost entirely a positive thing. And it contributed a lot to the game being so easy for me to sink into. And it just felt so familiar. And yet that also made the parts that are new and fresh stand out even more. So, I'm very comfortable with my pick for number one. Well, why don't we move on to Guillaume?
All right. Well, my number one, of 2013 is Pikmin 3 with its downloadable content. I probably wouldn't have said this just earlier, like a month ago. But when I actually went and picked up the DLC in order to talk about it on the show, that made me rediscover the missions in Pikmin 3, and since then I've logged in maybe 30 hours into the damn game. You know, I hadn't played it since I beat the game shortly after it came out in August, I believe. And, you know, so I finished the main quest, and that was that, and I barely touched the missions, and I don't think it left that much of an impression on me. I loved what I played, but, you know, that was that. And then I got addicted to the missions and, so yeah, in co-op and by myself and, just trying to beat my times and, trying to get the platinum on every mission has been an addiction and has been a ton of fun and really opened my eyes to the different strategies that are in the game. And, I go to bed at night and I'm still thinking about these levels, about these maps, and I'm thinking of, like, how come I couldn't get the platinum here? Like, I'm missing tons of time and I'm devising strategies. Oh, maybe I should throw my captain up here and that way, like, he'll pluck these Pikmins out of the ground and that gives me time to go around here and beat this enemy. And, so I'm working stuff, like, I'm thinking, you know, about this game when I shouldn't be, when I'm at work or when I'm trying to sleep. So it's become, you know, an actual addiction, but, in a good way. And, I really wouldn't have felt this way about the game if I had not gone back and done the missions. So I hope that people will give them a try and, you know, try to figure out exactly, well, you know, like try to get into the complexities of the game.
Yeah, it sounds like for you, it's one of those games where the joy of the game is in its mastery. You know, it's like it only really becomes fully realized, and you really only appreciate it when you play it at a very high level. And that takes time to get to that point, and a lot of devotion that maybe some people like me are not willing to put into it.
Yeah. I think personally, I think that for a game to have a lasting impression on me, there has to be some friction, not, you know, like in terms of difficulty, I have to kind of bang my head on a wall, at certain points in the game. And I have for the game to actually, linger with me. I think the reason why Super Mario 3D World is not my number one game is just because I was kind of through, done with it in a week, you know, and after that I was like, I'm not sure if I'm gonna go back to it or, you know, it's kind of done. This experience is over and it was kind of fleeting. And it's the same thing with, Link Between Worlds. I really loved playing the game, but at the same time, I understand where James is coming from when he says that the puzzles were too easy. There was not enough friction there. There was not enough, to keep me you know, thinking about the game when I wasn't playing it, or
or even afterwards, after you were done it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And Pikmin 3 really, you know, it stays with me mostly because, yeah, I'm trying to master these levels, and it's really, really, really hard. But it's really satisfying when you finally figure out a couple of tricks to beat your time and to get more points and to get those platinum medals. And I just love it.
Nice. All right. Well, speaking of friction, we're going to come around finally to John's number one game of the year.
Speaking of friction?
Speaking of friction.
If
well,
my guess is correct.
Is that John's rap name?
No, it's just, if my guess is correct, then
your guess will be correct, Johnny. And you know, it's funny that you guys mentioned, you know, needing hours in order to a game not being appreciated until much effort is put in and many hours of mastery are required. And
oh, this
my
is
number
the
one
case
pick,
study.
Yes, the case study is Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate for both 3DS, primarily for 3DS, but also for Wii. Had a great time with this game. Just you know, I think this is really kind of the game in which, you know, I really sort of fell in love with the series. I mean, I put it on the 3DS game, I put in 50 hours, and you know, and that's not even playing online. I really haven't even played the game online yet.
You played the Wii version quite a bit, also, didn't you?
Yeah, quite a little bit, but not nearly as much as the 3DS version.
Okay.
Mainly because I played it on the road a lot of the time. Which is one of the great things, which is what I loved about having it on 3DS, is the fact that I could take it anywhere I went. And it's the perfect kind of bite-sized experience where, you know, you sit down and you play for an hour, which is great for, like, you know, a train commute or anything like that. And, you know, you kind of have your one shot at a monster, and, you know, that's it. You can put it down, and then you come back, you know, and, you know, if you didn't get it the first time, then, you know, you can just try it again at some point down the line. Just really, really good. And also, I really liked what Capcom did, kind of encouraging people to, you know, move their save files back and forth between the 3DS and the Wii, you know, versions of it, which was really, really good. And in terms of playing it on Wii U, it really expands the experience a little bit just by making the worlds a lot more panoramic. They, you know, it's not the greatest looking Wii U game you're going to see, but just being able to kind of, experience sort of the, you know, the sound and, you know, the kind of expansive worlds, you know, in HD really added a lot, especially when you're used to looking at it on the small 3DS screen.
And I would think if you're going to eventually get more into the online play, the Wii U is just such a better platform for doing that.
Oh. Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's a lot of the reason why I didn't play it online much, is I haven't played the Wii U version too much. So, but that would definitely be my online platform of choice. So, yeah. I mean, it's just a great game. I mean, it takes a lot to get into, and it's certainly not for everybody, but for me, it was definitely the game that I played the hell out of it this year, and I certainly enjoyed it above and beyond anything else out there.
All right. Well, that is going to do it. Thank you guys for sharing your list. We actually had surprisingly quite little overlap. I think, you know, outside of the pretty, expected choices like Mario, Zelda, Rayman, there really wasn't a whole lot at all. And, we ended up with a pretty, pretty broad set of games there. So no matter what you're into, I think there's probably something out there, on a Nintendo system for you to check out. So hopefully we gave you some ideas. And I hope you enjoyed listening to us cover these, but I know I had fun putting it together, had fun hearing what these guys had to pick out. So that is going to lay 2013 to rest, and you know, we're going to look forward to 2014. We'll probably within the next week or two.
We're in 2014.
Yeah, well, I know, obviously, but you know, there's not a whole lot going on at the moment in video games, so we'll be looking forward to more things. I think we've got some Nintendo Directs probably coming up in the near future, and some financial reports if you're into that shit. More importantly, you know, we'll probably do some predictions soon. I know that's a popular segment, even though I kind of despise doing it. So we'll probably get around to that.
I love doing it, but only when I'm right,
which is never. So.
No, I still own all you folks on Zelda.
Yeah, you're probably a lot more right than we are, but that's still not saying very much.
So I play it close. I assume the worst that come out ahead.
Yeah. But we are running long, so I'm going to have to wrap it up. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Send in your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Check out the TalkBack, the NeoGAF thread. Rate and review us on iTunes, and stick around for next week when we'll be back with more Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye. Later.
I'm my own top five. There is a very similar mechanic in Four Heroes where you had to charge up for these really powerful attacks. And you'd basically, a boss fight would end if you could trigger off all the characters would use that really powerful attack in a row.
Mm-hmm.
You pretty much end any boss fight right there. So the trick was having to try to maintain balance long enough to get to that point. And there was this constant of, I'm going to trade off a little bit of my cashed up energy to keep the party going. And it was just like, all right, one more turn. If I can hold out one more turn, I could do this. It's this sort of flips it by saying, okay, I can attack now, or I can save it up to just chain out attacks later.
You know, and the other cool thing about banking is it makes certain, because of the job system, you have characters who have wildly different move sets. And in the demo, it's not as pronounced, but I'm sure in the full game, as you get more and more and more abilities for all these different jobs, this would come into play more. But like, I was reading on GAF about it, and I was trying to figure out like, how do you use this? What is the strategy here? And one person who I think had played the European version mentioned that, for instance, it's extremely useful with a white mage character, because that's a kind of character in JRPGs where a lot of times they're not really doing much. They have weak attacks. And they have fairly low defense as well. And a lot of times, I mean, they're healers. So if your party doesn't need to be healed, they're kind of a wasted character. They sit around and they don't do much. But then when you need a white mage to take care of people, you often need them to do more than one thing. So in other words, you're fighting a boss. They do this huge thing that almost wipes out everybody. You need that white mage to like bring people back to life and cure a bunch of status ailments and do a lot of healing all at once in order to keep the party alive. So with a white mage, you can have them default whenever they're not needed. So if everybody else is attacking and things are, you know, like at the beginning of the battle, things are generally doing okay for now, have them default, save up those moves for when you actually need them. And when the boss comes in big and strong later, then you have someone who's ready to respond to that.
Or if things are really dire, you can gamble and say, all right, I'm going to push the white mage into debt. And just, I've got to do something. I'm about to get screwed.
Yeah. My favorite is, you know, if I felt like everyone else is kind of running out of juice, I'm running out of the items, I've done a lot of damage to the boss, but he's not slowing down, and I don't really know how close he is to being dead, that's when I would go super negative with the black mage and just say, I know he's weak to thunder. I'm going to hit him with thunder like 4 times in a row. If this doesn't kill him, nothing will. And
I'm done anyway. I'm going to lose.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, I mean, I've only got, everybody's dead. There's only one character left. I need them to go for the Hail Mary. And that's when you go, when you just brave, 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 go super negative, throw everything you've got left, and maybe it works. It's so cool.
I will say one character set that I found particularly amusing for this strategy is the swordsman, which is kind of a samurai style character. He slashes a bunch of times and does a lot of damage with each slash of his sword. But he has a skill, Ikkakuse, which will give him, like, means he hits more times. So each move, he'll, as opposed to slashing 3 times, he'll slash 5 times. Which means you instantly do about 40% more damage.
Mm-hmm.
But he also has a move where occasionally he gets an extra turn. So he'll attack. You'll say attack three times, but he'll actually attack a fourth time. So you use one of your brave points to use that skill, and then you attack three times, and you almost always still get four attacks out of it. But you've then basically said, all right, I'm going to get a free attack, and I'm going to increase the number of attack by about 40%. So I'm getting two more free attacks. So by chaining all this stuff together, you end up with like seven attacks every three turns.
Yeah, and if that doesn't kill the enemy, that guy's going to be useless for a long time afterward. So you better hope that really does the job.
Or if you do what I do and you've just defaulted him up until the point where he can fire that all out, and then you start defaulting him again.
Sure.
I just turtle until I'm ready to go, and then everybody unleashes hell on the guy.
Yeah. Anyway, we've talked enough about a freaking demo, but obviously James and I are pretty excited about it, and it's for an early, early part of the year game. I think it's going to make a big splash. I think a lot of people are going to be really happy with it.
And it's been a huge success in Japan.
Yeah. And
a much needed win for Square Enix.
I expect it'll do pretty well over here too, actually. I think handheld is the place to do a big RPG like this. I think in the West, you can't really pull that off on a console. It's not going to be super successful, but on a handheld, I think it's still possible. And if Square really gets behind it, we'll see.
Well, I think more Nintendo, game's getting some good buzz too. I mean, I think people have been intrigued with it from the very start.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, because it the first day we just came out and it looked.
We got to move on.
I agree.
I'm sorry. All
right. Jerk.